No. We'll do it live! Fuck it!
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, it still records even if you call me. Look at that technology. Oh, I'm actually, I'm just kind of on a little bit of a weird, like, a footy high, if you will, because just watching the drama, and I know nobody really likes it when it goes up. I don't know what the fucking term is in Britain, if it's PKs or penalty kicks, whatever it is. It's dramatic.
It's England lose.
Well, you guys don't even need to go to any of that stuff. You guys got beat by a country the size of Montana. And, alright, you know what? I've already decided that most of this is going to be going on air. Well, I should do a proper introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, cats and kittens, I'm Mike Coughlin. This is the Half Guarded Hour. I don't like the name, but it's going to stick at halfguarded.com. We have our resident British expert, Will Cooling, on. You may remember him from the really, really good explanation of what Brexit was. And we're here now to talk about what's happened since then, because I guess everything in England has gone batshit crazy. And so, Will, before I say how are you, I have to ask, are all the Polish people out of England now?
No, they're still there. They're kind of wandering around dazed, thinking, nothing's changed. That's where we're kind of like, oh, this is a bit weird. And that, this is going to be a unfolding story over the next few years, because nothing happens quickly, although an awful lot of other stuff has happened in the past week. Because, yeah, British politics has gone bonkers, and to the point where it's hurt our football team.
The moment that the vote went through, all I could picture was every single tabloid had it ready that when England lost in the Euros, it would be England Brexits from the Euros. And I feel like that was everywhere. I'm looking at you, The Sun, you evil, horrible shit newspaper that blamed Liverpool for everything. But I don't know if that really happened.
Well, I mean, and of course, the problem is that, of course, if you take England and exit and put them together, the word you spell is exit. which kind of ruins it all, ruins the joke.
Yeah, you kexit doesn't really sound good, so. I'm also, by the way, I want to say I'm really surprised, though, and I'm confused, because I heard all this stuff, you know, listen to you and do my own research and such, that these people all predicted, oh my gosh, if England leaves the EU, that's it. The country's dead. You're going to become like the next Indonesia or some irrelevant country that nobody knows where it really is. And instead, I just read that the FTSE, the British stock market, that's right, people, I looked up the acronym, had its biggest week in 5 years. And that doesn't seem like it makes any sense. I thought you guys just are doomed and on a path to economic ruin forever.
Well, what basically happened was, is like you were saying, that no one thought it was going to happen. And what happened, and it was even worse, because what actually happened was, is some of the big multinational firms, such as the big trading firms in London, paid for their own exit polls. And their exit polls, by all the rumours, showed Remain winning quite easily. Mm-hmm. So by the end of trading on Thursday night and overnight trading, everything was soaring. And then Friday and Monday, the FTSE had its biggest hangover from their previous complacency, and so it cratered. It's like, oh crap, we thought we were going to stay in and we're not. And then since then, it's kind of been in a bounce back. And part of that bounce back is because some of the threats that were made to the people, if they were bad and voted leave, aren't being done. So, for example, one of the things that was threatened is we'll put up interest rates. And the Bank of England came out and said, we're not putting up interest rates. We're actually going to print more money. We're going to do more quantitative easing, which is obviously great if you're a bank. And we're going to provide all this extra money for liquidity. So the governments came out and said, you know, that stuff about not borrowing more money if we were to leave the EU, forget about it, we'll borrow more money, we're not going to try and get back into surplus.
So a lot
of it is the fact that, and also this is going back to the thing of, we know nothing's happening soon.
I wanted to ask, when do you guys officially leave? Is it 2 years? I don't really know what's going on as far as, like, are you guys done now? Like, are you forever immediately ostracized from Europe, or is there a period, a transition? What really happens there?
So basically, this is where it gets brilliant, right? So there's a very clear process for how to leave the European Union, which is you go to European Union and you invoke what's called Article 50, which is basically is a formal notification that you leave, at which point the rest of the European Union, which would be the other 27 countries, can officially shun you. And they can officially stop inviting you to meetings. They can officially start talking behind your back. And they basically scurry away, make up a deal, and present it to you the last possible minute before this 2-year window's up. And then they take this, otherwise, or it's WTO terms, which will be, you know, 4% tariff on most goods, you know, 12% on cars, no access to the European banking sector for the City of London. And so the British are kind of looked at for, you know what, guys? We're going to wait to formally notify you. Oh, yeah, so we are definitely leaving. Now, we've had the referendum and everything, but we're just going to take our time and work out what we're going to ask you for. So all the Europeans are like, well, you really do need to give us a formal notification soon. Like, yeah, sure, you know, maybe October, November time. Like, what? Yeah, maybe even next year. Like, so, yeah, so at the moment, it's kind of surreal because we have had the referendum to leave, but the referendum was always only advisory, which is why Vox, the American news website, did a thing about, oh, look at how nice and simple language the British use when they're writing ballot papers compared to the crazy proposition text that American states use. And it's like, yeah, well, that's because American propositions have legal force, so they're written in legalese.
Oh, what a novel concept. Oh my gosh. Oh, yeah, if people vote for something, it has to happen. Who would have ever thought that was an appropriate way to run a democracy?
So where we are now is because we did do this, because it's only advisory, it's kind of like, are we either going to stay in the European Union or leave the European Union? And people said, well, we'll leave the European Union. And we're like, and now the politicians are going like, okay, but what does leave actually mean?
So the elected officials, all the members of parliament, in theory could just say, yeah, we're not going to do that. You guys all just have to stick with it.
Well, it's amazing because, you can't underestimate how big a shock this result was. A month ago, all the opinion polls are showing that Brexit was not going to happen, and there had been a couple of good weeks of Brexit, and then the final week, the final few days, all the opinion polls showed clear movement toward leave. Final polls all showed leave in the lead, with a couple of exceptions. And so it just kind of felt like, okay, it looks like it's not going to happen. And then leave does happen, yeah, by a margin of 1.7 million votes, a fairly clear margin. Mm-hmm. And all hell breaks loose. And you have got a lot of people saying, but no, we don't want to leave the European Union. There's all these horrible racist people and old people and people who are poor. And we're nice young graduates who speak many different languages. Well, we don't speak different languages because we're English. But we have friends all over the country that speak English, all over the world that speak English to us. So we should stay in the European Union. So, like, today in London, there was a 50,000 person march for the European Union. And just thinking, guys, referendum was a week ago. Maybe have the have your big march beforehand.
You know, it's funny you say that because here in the States, Donald Trump, as he is wont to do, makes this all about himself. And it's kind of a bit of a laughing joke. But I think there is something to the fact that there is this great number of people in, we'll say, the Anglo-Western area who don't feel like they're being listened to, and they're just reflexively saying, you know what, I don't care if we blow it all up, you're not paying attention to me. And we're the, you know, Richard Nixon called it the great silent majority, and it seems like those people are out in force, and it happened in Britain, and it's kind of taken hold a little bit here in America, and all these pollsters, I mean, in America, it's very famous that the polls never accurately represent anybody in the right wing. Like, it doesn't work out. And then you get things like John Kerry losing, and everybody goes, but the polls all said he was going to win, but the real results said he would say he loses. Well, the results must be wrong. Like, the actual counted votes are wrong in some people's minds, and the small sample size poll is correct. And I get this sense that there's kind of that similar, let's just call Donald Trump, I'll give Donald Trump all the credit because he already did. So it seems something similar there.
It's an interesting one because I think what Brexit happened, and I think this is true of Trump as well in the primaries, is that one of the, if you're talking pollsters, one of the things they say is that telephone polls are the best. In terms of their accuracy compared to online polls. One of the telephone polls is that they're not very good at catching people who don't have cell phones. Don't have telephone phones or are unlikely to be in during the day to answer their telephone, stuff like that. And so it looks like for Brexit that online polls are better at capturing white working class voters. That people who hasn't tended to vote in large numbers in previous elections, but were going to turn out in force for this. And it's possible that may be underrepresented, in America as well. I mean, Upshot for the New York Times had this very point when they're saying, actually look at 2012, you actually look at where the votes were. It's probably likely that more white people voted for Obama than we previously thought, that the electorate wasn't quite as his vote wasn't quite as dominated by college graduates and ethnic minorities as we may have once thought. So I think there's a possibility of that. The one problem for any attempt of doing a Brexit style campaign in America is you have less white people. So, Britain is 85% white. And the issue was more nebulous. It wasn't just about immigration. You could build a coalition of other people. Whereas for Trump, it's a less white electorate, and it's more clear. His pitch is more clearly focused on immigration. Then probably makes it a bit more tricky for him to run. But I mean, look, I can well understand why he sees the parallels with himself, quite clearly.
Yeah. By the way, for everybody listening, Will and I are recording this on a Saturday, but I'm putting this out on July 4th because I love the idea that on the day when America had the original Brexit, when we beat the British in a fight for independence, we will talk about nothing but Britain. Because that's that's my trolling nature. So you guys are just 200 plus years behind the times as far as it really doesn't work for my analogy. But
yeah, well, a good joke that's doing the rounds Britain's heard so much about how great it is to be a developing country from all those countries we used to rule that we thought we'd try it ourselves.
Well, it's funny you say that, because one of the things I've seen, and I see all these people, and they're like, oh, Britain is going to be in trouble. This isn't good for them. But I always think, I'm like, but Britain is not a small country. This is not Slovenia leaving. This is Great Britain. This is the United Kingdom. It's one of the, top 10 economies on the planet. The European Union has a lot to lose by Britain leaving. And it seemed like everybody's just focused on, oh, Britain will be worse off. It's like, yeah, so is the EU. Kind of like if California left America, yeah, that would, that would suck, and California would have their issues, but America would be like, oh shit, We just lost the sixth biggest economy in the world. We probably kind of need those guys around. And everybody focuses on what's happening with Britain. And meanwhile, it's like, I feel like right now France and Germany are looking around going, oh, shit, we have to carry the whole load now? Fuck you, Greece. No more money. Just make some euros and, you know, learn to not spend all your money on stupid Olympics or something.
Well, it's a weird one, really, because France just want to push us out the door. I mean, you could quite clearly see that France just wants us out now.
No, not France. Come on.
Partly because we've always kind of been an awkward member. I mean, this is one of the things. So this rise of anti-Europeanism is a continent-wide thing. So, you know, France has a national front. Germany is alternative for Germany. You know, Italy has Northern League. There's Austria had a far-right politician almost win president. So this wave of anti-Europeanism is unusual. There's left-wing populism movements also across the southern Europe as well. The difference with England is that in England that there was pre-existing Euroscepticism that hasn't just been fanned by the growth of migration from Eastern Europe. So, and this is kind of what you saw with Brexit. Brexit was kind of building this. So you had your existing Eurosceptic movement that was a combination of old-fashioned socialists who knew it stopped them having tariffs and state aid, and your more right-wing guys who thought it was giving them too much regulations. We've just got this blob of people who are just kind of pissed off with there being too much immigration. Now, what the Europeans are scared of is that you might be in the middle of a domino effect. And that makes it really difficult for them to work out what to do, because in theory, yeah, you know, you give Britain the best deal possible. You kind of get Britain to agree to a halfway house deal where they do leave, but they still pay some money into the pot. They still cooperate on a lot of things. But they can't give Britain too good a deal, because if they give Britain too good a deal, then maybe some other countries will think, well, actually, that deal looks better than what we're having to put up with, so maybe we should leave. And that's why we're kind of in this impasse at the moment, which is kind of Britain going, well, of course we want to stay part of the single market. And the Europeans going, well, that's great. You do have to accept complete freedom of movement to retain single market access. And then Britain going, well, maybe we're not that worried about the single market. Maybe. And so it's an incredible impasse, and there's not a clear way through, because, you know, our politicians really do want to keep single market access because it would really hurt the City of London. So basically, single market, as we were talking about last time, you know, involves a common regulatory framework.
Right.
One of the key aspects
like
that
it's kind of like NAFTA and all the other free trade agreements where everybody can trade. There's nobody imposes any tariffs, and it kind of treats everybody like states here in America are.
Yeah, that's it. So it's NAFTA on steroids. So it would be like if Mexico and Canada had agreed to enter the American regulatory framework. So like the FTA, so the Food and Drug Agency would monitor stuff from Canada. Give it the stamp in Canada. So if you were building something in Canada, you just know you could send it over to America without even having to bother the American authorities. And one of the most important things single market gives Britain is what's called a passport for its banks, which means despite not being in the euro, we're the biggest clearinghouse for euro business on the continent. Hmm. And we kind of don't want to give it up, but we do want to control immigration. And the Europeans are saying, well, of course you can control immigration. You have to give up your passport. You want to retain the ability to do all this Euro business for the City of London. Then you have to have unfettered immigration from the rest of Europe. And so this is kind of the the square, the circle, no, the circle that must be squared by the next prime minister, because this is the bonkers thing. We no longer have a government.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I saw that David Cameron, effectively announced that he's going to resign in, I think it's October. And for the Americans, that's kind of the equivalent of, I would guess, you know, George Bush saying, okay, I didn't get what I wanted, I'm done. It's different because parliamentary elections are different than what we have, but it's still, he's a right of center candidate who just had basically what is probably could fairly be called a right of center referendum passed, and yet he's going to lose. And I don't know who's next. It sounds like, I don't know, Boris Johnson, who apparently we have to talk about, because I guess somebody said he's the Donald Trump of England, but I don't know really what comes next now.
This is a tale. So basically, yes. So David Cameron loses a referendum, and he quits, and he quits for a simple reason, which is, you know, this decision to leave the European Union is going to, you know, reshape our foreign, economic, trade, public spending policies, all against his best advice to the people. And in the words he said to one of his aides, "Why should I stay around and do the hard shit? I.e. these idiots have convinced the people to do something that I think is a bad idea. Why on earth should I carry the can?" And he also knew that whilst people wanted him to stay for a bit to kind of keep the show on the road, he would then be under pressure to resign later on because people would be worried about him trying to unpick the referendum result later. So, yeah, he had to go. Anybody really thought about it that deeply knew he had to go. What then happened was all bedlam broke loose. We had to basically now revert to the Conservative Party electing a leader. Cameron's still Prime Minister until the Conservative Party kind of agrees a new leader of their party to be the new Prime Minister.
Before you get going, because in America we basically have a two-party system, and in a very basic way, in England, they don't elect the Prime Minister. What happens is the party who has the most votes in America would be the Speaker of the House, essentially, becomes the President. But generally, they don't have one guy who has one system, you know, one party that has 50% of all the votes. So they form these weird coalitions, and you know, you get, like, in America, it would be the equivalent of the Libertarians, Republicans, the Democrats, and the Green Party. And the Libertarians and the Green Party say, "All right, if we combine, we get 51% of the vote, and we'll have this guy be in charge." And I'm curious, because you mentioned the Conservatives, is that there are the Tories, who I think are kind of like the mainstream Republicans in America. You have UKIP, which is kind of like the Tea Party in America. And then, but the Conservatives, is that just a general catch-all? Is that different? Where do they fit in with all of this?
Okay, so it's why we don't have a pure two-party system, but coalitions, unlike in most European countries, coalitions are actually quite unusual in Britain, because we do retain first-past-the-post. So our elections, with those parliamentary system, our elections are more like yours, where it's voting for one constituency. So the Tories have, although they didn't get 50% of the vote, so the Tories would have gotten 37-38% of the vote at the last election. They just got a majority, literally by the skin of their teeth. They have a majority of 12 in the parliament of 658 MPs.
Wow.
So they've just gone. So it is only the Tories. Tories and Conservative interchangeable. The official party name is Conservatives, and everybody calls them Tory. Tory is, I think it is right, Tory was what their enemies used to call them when the party was first founded in the 1600s.
1600s, everyone. 200 years, no, 100 years, I fucked up my math, before America even existed. That's how old this shit is. Holy shit. You think that America's got entrenched interest? Go to fucking Britain.
And the I believe it's an Irish word for a pig thief is what Tory originally meant.
Pixies? Like the little fairies or whatever? Not the attractive women with the short haircut that I really like, or the band that was awesome.
So anyway, so you have the Tories, and so they get to have their leadership election, and things got weird. So we kind of, you know, a couple of people are declaring. We knew Theresa May would be equivalent of Homeland Security minister, declared as kind of like the stability candidate. She was technically Remain, but she kind of played a very cautious referendum campaign, strong record on immigration. But everyone thought, well, it'd be her and Boris Johnson. So Boris Johnson, the Leave candidate, you know, has been referred to Donald Trump, I think unfairly, you know. Whatever you say about Boris Johnson, he's an actual politician. You know, he has been an MP since 2001. He's former mayor of London.
What is an MP for everybody listening?
Oh, member of parliament.
Sorry. Okay,
member of parliament. He's been a member of parliament, and so you know he's a real politician.
He has bad hair though.
But that's his gimmick, you know. He is the type of guy who kind of spends an hour in front of the mirror trying to make his hair look like he'd just woken up. So
there's something really weird about that too. Like the idea that people that are kind of, you know, conservative and therefore, like, you know, old school manly men, blah blah blah, and then they do all this time and spend all this time on their hair, they're 20-year-old girls.
It is changing, but this is one of the big differences between America and Britain, because in America, obviously, traditionally, there's been a massive gender gap in favour of conservative parties, in terms of men are more likely to vote conservative. But until relatively recently, it was the opposite. Women were more likely to vote Tory. Women were the more conservative group, because men tended to be in unionised occupations, therefore more likely to vote Labour. Hmm. We get to Thursday morning, and everybody's expected the two serious candidates, Theresa May and Boris Johnson, to declare. The day before, we had this weird situation where Michael Gove, who was the second most senior Tory campaigner for Leave during a referendum, and was Boris Johnson's campaign manager for the leadership, an email from his wife to him had leaked, talking about Gove needing to be strong with Boris to get concrete assurances, to be stubborn, not take no for an answer. Everybody is just like, ah, ha, ha, ha. Next day, Gove demands a meeting, calls Boris 5 minutes before making a statement that he's no longer going to be Boris Johnson's campaign manager, because he thinks Boris Johnson is terribly disorganized, has been saying inconsistent things, doesn't know how to tie his own shoelaces without help, and Michael Gove is now going to stand to be Tory leader. And by the way, about 10-15 people of Michael Gove's friends who were going to be part of Boris Johnson's campaign team and had already declared for Boris Johnson are all going to defect away from Boris Johnson as well. So with literally an hour before a couple of hours before nominations are due to close, Boris Johnson has lost his campaign manager, 20 of his closest aides, and so he goes in, makes this big long speech about that is outlined in his policy platform, outlining what he thinks needs to be done for the country. And at the end of it, he says, oh yeah, but by the way, because of the events of today, I've decided that I can't stand, so I will not be a candidate for Tory leadership. Literally, a politician in the front row starts crying because she's so shocked at the news. So Boris Johnson is out. He's out of the running to be Prime Minister.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, and you know the rest of the DX thing with the road dog or whatever. This is why we left in 1776. Be proud of America, July 4th. We don't have, well, we have Donald Trump, but, and Hillary, oh, fuck, we might be worse off. Damn it!
You don't have these type of machinations once you've elected a president. You know, you elect the president, and then that president is there unless both they and the vice president disappear.
and then you have to have awkward conversations with Congress. But
other
than that,
actually, that's actually not true. The 20th or 22nd Amendment, 20th, is actually put in place a line of secession, and it goes president, vice president, speaker of the House, cabinet member. We're pretty anal about this, because I guess at one point in during FDR's reign as president, people thought, well, what if everybody dies at the same time, even though that's never, ever happened and never will happen?
Isn't that not a constitutional amendment? Isn't that an act of Congress that people think is constitutional?
No, it's an amendment to the Constitution was amended to actually set out the line of secession, and they go through the whole rigmarole of, all right, president dies, vice president gets it, and then this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, and that's why when you see, like, Battlestar Galactica, the TV show, they had, like, you know, some education minister, if you will, became president of whatever, and that's something that would happen in America. I don't know if it would happen in England. But,
So the way that happened in England, the way it works is that the Queen would get to pick the new Prime Minister, because that's, technically, that's it. So, again, this is evolving about things being advisory. Technically, we elect our MPs, and then, the incumbent Prime Minister has been defeated, he will go and resign to the Queen, and he will tell the Queen, I think you should pick the guy who's got the most MPs. But no, he could completely play a joker now and say, you know what? Don't go for him. Go for somebody else. Knock yourself out. And it'd be up to the Queen whether she'd just do something crazy. But entirely, if we did have an issue where half our parliament got destroyed by some sort of Independence Day disaster, it'd be the Queen's decision who got to be the next Prime Minister.
The Queen actually has real power?
Well, she has real powers, but she chooses not to use them.
This is...
So technically...
What the fuck?
Every act of Parliament needs to be agreed by the Queen, which she does in French, which is very suspicious.
What? Why would she do it in French? What the fuck is that?
Well, that's where the word Parliament comes from. We were run by the French for, like, the first 100, 200 years. Well, Normans, but, you know, French. For the first 200, 300 years of England's existence. And so an awful lot of our language and customs have a French influence.
I'm beginning to think that the EU is better off with you guys not part of it. What is wrong with you? The French? You're listening to French shit from 1,000 years ago? Not to mention the whole idea that you still have a God-appointed queen or king, like, in 2016... People still like the idea of, her fucking inbred ancestors produced her, and we also saw what happened with that with, you know, Prince Charles as next in line, and I know for a fact everybody in England is holding their breath going, ah, fuck, this guy's gonna be a king, oh shit, this is gonna be really embarrassing, when can we get rid of him and have William and that really cute wife of his be in charge of things?
Well, yeah, you're right. I think William's going to be just as bad, because William again. I mean, the thing is that the monarchy kind of survives because the current queen is very good at it. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I think a lot of countries deep down would probably rather have the queen represent them than their politicians. But that calculus comes a lot more different when you get some sort of tree and some sort of old guy with a bald spot who likes talking to trees. The thing with Britain is we never did what most countries did, which was have a revolution to stop the British ruling them. And so we never had, like, a revolutionary committee to sit down and say, well, how are we going to govern this place now that the British are not here, and, like, write down clear rules. So we kind of just made it up as we went along, and it was a series of tactical retreats from our establishment. So technically our constitution is a constitution of a maniacal dictatorship. You know it is still that the Queen or King's government has an incredible amount of power. To give you an example, when we have our budgets, our you know, yeah, our budget, and it was set the taxes for the future for forthcoming year. Most of that has to be done with legislation, like a normal country. But duties and excise, so things like tax on cigarettes, alcohol, that sort of thing, that doesn't need to go through Parliament, because back in the day, they were things that the king got to tax away from Parliament. And so literally, you'll have the chance to stand up and say, these will take effect from 6 p.m. tonight. Because they have that power. They don't need to wait for legislation on certain things.
Alright.
But it's all just because of how power has flown and been reformed over the years. So you do have these weird things. Technically, it is the Queen who picks a Prime Minister. Not the people.
Like, and I know it's just a rubber stamp, and if the monarchy never did it, like, if they just said, nah, fuck you guys, we're not going to do it, there would probably be a giant revolt and things like that, but it's still this weird, like, I always think that the monarchy exists for people like my mom, who loved Princess Diana, and she's got all these Princess Diana books around her house and shit like that. It's like, why do you like Princess Diana so much? Oh, she's so regal. I'm like, but it's a fucking holdover from a legitimate ancient time, and maybe that was the way to do things back in the day 1,000 years ago, but we have the internet now. You can just vote. In theory, we should be able to vote online, or at the very least, walk down the street to the library and vote. You don't need a king or queen anymore. It's just weird to me.
Well, look, I mean, but we do a lot. I mean, think of all the countries that still use our queen, even though they're independent. I mean, look at Canada. Canada still has today of a foreigner.
I laugh at Canada all the time that they have the fucking Queen of England on their fucking money. I'm like, really? Really, Canada? You want America to take you seriously? You have the Queen of England on your money. You know who America has? Presidents. And, like, dudes did great things. And we're going to have, like, we're going to change a $20 bill to Harriet Tubman, a woman who risked her life to free slaves. And you guys have Queen Elizabeth. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Well, we have other people on the other side. I mean, actually, the other one to make fun of Canada is they only got control of their own constitution in the 1980s. So even though they're independent, you know, pretty much from like 1930s, they only repatriated power of their constitution back from Westminster in the 1980s, because until then they were terrified of unpicking Quebec.
Oh yeah. Oh, the
fucking. So deep evidence, like, okay, come on, guys, we're a real country. We can be in charge of our own constitution now. Let's do it. It's the 1980s, for crying out loud. The Americans did this 200 years ago. They just had a big party a few years ago. We can do it.
Yeah, my favorite thing about the monarchy, and, like, I don't actually really give a shit because, again, it's ceremonial. The queen has, for the most part, never, like, gone against Parliament. It's just kind of quaint. They spend a lot of money that they probably shouldn't, but at the same time, it's like a national pride issue. It's kind of like a public works project in America. But the my favorite thing that you guys have done in the past, I think it was within the past 5 years, was the dumbest fucking law I had ever heard. And I say this, everybody, as a practicing attorney, I would be a barrister and solicitor if I was in England. Oh, I know the difference, too. You fuckers passed a law to change the rules of secession so that if a girl was born before a boy, she could become queen. That it would not be, you know, male-dominated secession. Mm-hmm. And I'm listening and I'm reading this going, you are concerned about who is succeeding who? Meanwhile, you're skipping the issue of a fucking inbred bunch of retards are fucking running your country in theory, and you're concerned about sex, the equality of the sexes, and not the fact that God chose these people to be running your country. You guys really have your priorities a little bit screwy there.
And the thing is, right, that wasn't like a 5-minute bill that someone jotted down and then rushed it through Parliament, because obviously you have to remember, as I said, you know, a lot of countries actually still have our queen or king as their head of state. So we had to, so the person who pushed it through had to have all these convoluted chats with the other countries of the Royal Commonwealth, so everyone was aligned and pushing it through at the same time, so that the lines of succession couldn't be broken or diverge at any future point. So yeah, that was a bit silly.
I mean, technically,
you're not, someone who's part of the royal family is not meant to be Royal Catholic, Roman Catholic,
right?
Because you know, Church of England, established church. So right. Yeah, these are the interesting things of our wacky system.
Well, I think we actually talked about it last time, and I've always found it funny as shit that Tony Blair, everyone in the world knew that he was Catholic. His wife's Catholic, but he could not officially convert to Catholicism until he left office because the Church of England, you know, it wouldn't look good. And it's like, I don't know, again, it's, as an American, we're like, we're kind of this weird country because we're so big, we're so powerful. Hey, Independence Day, everybody, July 4th, rah, rah, rah. We had a good movie 20 years ago, and I don't know about the new one. But we are a very, you know, relatively new country compared to everyone in Europe, so we don't have all these historical hang-ups. But I'm like...
But actually, just one thing, you do, though. Because you look at JFK, he didn't make a big speech about how he wouldn't take orders from the Pope.
So the fear of Roman Catholicism was there
in America too.
There was that's true. In the 19, for a while there, the country is I don't want to say backward, but just kind of, we were very waspy. But nowadays, like, you know, Bernie Sanders did very well, and nobody for a second ever said, oh, but you know what? He's Jewish. That might be a problem. I had never heard that from anyone. Whereas, you know, in the 1960s, 50 years ago, people were like, oh, JFK's a Catholic. He's going to listen to the Pope. But you know what? He still got elected. He still got elected and is one of our most beloved and revered presidents, only pretty much because he died before he could do anything important. And he was kind of attractive and he fucked Marilyn Monroe, which, you know, give the guy credit for that. But it's like, it's just weird, like, in this modern age of ours, where we're all pretty much enlightened, that Tony Blair could not officially convert to Catholicism because it would fuck up his political, standing. It's like, who cares? Why would anyone care?
It was very much in his own head, because I don't think anybody would have cared. I mean, so those who don't know, so technically, and this is where it gets a bit quirky, like a lot of things, so... Britain used to have four established churches. Yes. Mm-hmm. Because nothing's simple.
Of course.
So we used to have Church of Ireland, Church of Wales, Church of England, Church of Scotland.
Wait, Church of Ireland? What the I've never heard of that one. I thought they were all just Catholics.
No. What do you mean? There are Protestants in Ireland.
Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland only.
In at this point, so when the Church of Ireland was there were Protestants all over, because there used to be an enclave of Protestants on the Irish south east coast, and there was also Protestants in Dublin as well, and the aristocracy of Ireland, of the whole of Ireland, was also Protestant.
Oh, of course.
So it was still a very small minority, and the concentration where Protestants made a majority of the population was in Northern Ireland, but there were Protestants dotted about. But anyway, you had an Anglican Church of Ireland, as the established Church of Ireland, which was clearly a nonsense because the vast majority of the population was Roman Catholic, and that was disestablished in the 1860s. You had in Wales an Anglican church. So Anglican was a great church. So in England, people kept killing each other because whether they were Protestant or Roman Catholic. And so Queen Elizabeth I came and said, well, how about we create a church that that is so vague on key aspects of Christianity that if you kind of feel a bit Catholic-y, that you can still be Catholic-y. And if you feel a bit Protestant-y, you can still be Protestant-y. But the key thing is you swear allegiance to me and we're all happy. And that's kind of the compromise that's stuck since her. So the Anglican Church is a Protestant church, technically, but it's kind of a bit, there are aspects of it in certain areas that leans more to Catholicism than other Protestant churches. So anyway, so in Wales, you actually have almost like American style Protestants. You know, you have Baptists, that are the dominant form of Christianity. They did not like Anglicanism. They thought it was an English church. So in Wales, it was also disestablished in the 1910s. So we now have two established churches, Church of Scotland, Church of England, that just happen to be completely different. So the Church of Scotland is Presbyterianism. So that isn't anything to do with Anglicanism. That's you know, Calvinism. That's predestination.
Right.
Very different type of Christianity. The Queen is meant to adhere to both because she's the head of both churches. So if she's in England, she is an Anglican. And when she goes to Scotland, she becomes a Presbyterian. Yes, that makes sense.
Actually, the entire time you're saying this, all I can think of is that Wales, the Welsh, which are, they're the same people. They're just a bunch of pasty white people that cannot go out in the sun for more than 10 minutes and not get burned. Everybody on that same fucking rock looks exactly the same. Your accents are a little different, but for the most part, you're the same people. And all I'm thinking is, yeah, Wales advanced in the Euros and England didn't. And I think it's hilarious. And yes, a lot of that's because Gareth Bale is a fucking, I think he's stepping up as number two behind Messi. I mean, Messi's a god still, but I think this is the time when Bale is telling Ronaldo, dude, I'm the fucking shit right now. Because you're taking a country or a region or whatever the fuck they call it with, like, I don't know, 15 people that are advancing in the Euros, and there are actually players on this team. For everybody in America, the European Championships, like every country in Europe plays soccer, and they go through a round robin tournament, blah blah blah. Wales is a little tiny part of Great Britain and the UK, but it's not part of England, and they have this guy named Gareth Bale, who is probably one of the top five players in the world, and then they also have people on their national team who don't actually have clubs right now. They don't play for anyone. That's how low they are. Very few of their people play it above, like, you know, League One or the championship. Yeah, and they're still doing well. And I don't really know where I was going with that, other than just to laugh at England, because somebody said, and it was the funniest thing. Stevie Nicholls, Liverpool legend from Scotland, and he said that when Iceland beat England in the Euros, that was the greatest moment in Scottish football history.
We can talk about the Euro Championship. So, the interesting thing with Wales, they are a weird side, because they have about four or five players that are genuinely awesome, would probably get into a lot of people's sides. So people like Bale, people like Aaron Ramsey.
Right.
And they have a lot of journeymen, like you're saying. But, you know, they play a very clear style. They fight for each other. And they don't get discouraged. And they can go down, but they come back. They move the ball fast. They tackle hard. You know, it's exactly what as an England fan, you want England to be playing like, rather than the confused, muddle, slow-paced mess that Roy Hodgson served up. But I don't think Bale scored every game of the group stage. But I don't think he's had that great game yet. You know, he's
no,
I
think that he is just so good and so dynamic that he draws defenses towards him, mm-hmm. and they're all so scared of him, which lets Ramsey and some of these other guys, you know, a little more freedom. And to me, it's really fun to see all these post-match celebrations, and you can see the true joy in his face of knowing, yeah, he could have been on, he could have played for England, and it would have been fine. It would have been acceptable by FIFA's weird ass criteria. I don't know, and you know how that shit works. But he said, no, I'll be Welsh. And, in America on ESPN, we have, ESPN FC, which is, one of my favorite programs. We have Dan Thomas, and it's all run by, foreigners, not Americans. And, Dan Thomas is the lead host, and he said, my father is Welsh. He has never sworn in his life. And yet when Wales advanced, I got this obscenity-filled message from him about how happy he was.
There was a brilliant one. They was Sky was showing like the fan park in Cardiff when the third goal goes, which by the way was a great fucking goal, great header. And they showed the crowd going mad. But the very very front of in front of the camera, there's this one guy who clearly is so drunk he can't take anything in. He's just standing there as all his friends are going crazy. You can almost hear him going, "What?" Oh, but I mean, one of the things, Wales is one of the areas of Europe where traditionally football's been a second sport. Because Wales' national sport is rugby union.
Yeah, right.
And that's been less and less and less over time. But, you know, so it's a tremendous achievement for them to do as well. I mean, you think about it, you know, Ryan Giggs, obviously, you know, great, great, great player from Man U. Never got close to playing an international tournament.
Actually, for the record, as a Liverpool fan, he's a piece of shit and he should die. And I hope he walks into traffic and gets run over by a bunch of your double-decker buses. That's all I'll say.
But, I mean, now, look, Portugal are weird. They have really shit side, but they keep getting results. But, you know, there's no reason to think Wales can't beat the Portuguese.
Oh, my dream is for at least one of Wales or Iceland. I mean, everybody in the world is rooting for Iceland right now. It's such a good story. They have their cool, slow clap. None of their players are like big superstars. And all of them, if you said, hey, this is someone from Iceland, and you looked at the guy, you go, oh yeah, that dude's from fucking Iceland. And maybe it comes across as racist, but like, I was watching like Ireland, and like, they had a black guy as a goalkeeper. And I'm thinking, okay, yeah, he was born in Ireland, that's fine, but like, people want to see traditionally Irish looking dudes or traditionally, you know, Scottish.
What about Finn Lizzy?
What?
Finn Lizzy. You heard of Finn Lizzy, Boys Back in Town?
Yeah.
That was an Irish band. Lead singer was black.
Really?
Yeah, lead singer Finn Lizzy's black.
Fucking, you know what's funny? I actually wrote this down because I'm kind of curious about it. And I think it's one of the things that all of Europe is struggling with is that America is, by definition, a country of immigrants. Mm-hmm. And we are unique in that when people say something is un-American, they can actually point to a collective belief. You can say, all right, Americans believe in the Constitution, free speech, own a gun, and own a black person until the 13th Amendment came along. Things like that. Whereas in Europe, if you're Russian, you are Russian, and it doesn't matter if it's communism or the czars or Putin running things. Same with the French. Same with the English. You're an Englishman, regardless if you have a queen and a king and a dictatorship or a parliament. And I feel like Europe has an issue right now with assimilation. And it's very different in America. We're proud of like, all right, yeah, we have, issues with, Mexicans coming in and all that, but it'll go away because eventually they'll just like, we'll take their tacos and burritos and like, yeah, that's part of America. Like we did with every other culture there is. You know, the Italians brought pasta and shit like that. And now we just go to Olive Garden, which is not Italian at all, but yeah, it's the American version of Italian. And same with every other ethnicity. Whereas, in Europe, there is something to be said for being part of a specific country, but also culture. Because if I say, hey, what does an Italian look like versus what does a Swedish person look like? You have a very clear image in your head. The Swedish guy is 6'4". His name is Sven. He has a hammer and he's blonde and blue-eyed. And the Italian guy is greasy, black-haired, and lives with his mom. And I feel like there's this weird thing in Europe where they don't want to, because they know it's kind of wrong to be like, you know, if the brown people from Algeria come in, like, we should accept them because they're good people, but they're not like all of us. And I see that, you know, yeah. In England, is, you know, you look at the Polish, they're white people, but they're not English. And it's a weird phenomenon where, like, you're trying to keep your culture and your heritage, but you don't want to be, you know, bigots. But the only way to keep some of that going is to be bigots. Like, I remember the best example of it ever is the French actually have, for people that don't know, the French have a government-sponsored institution that is devoted to nothing more than coming up with French words for new concepts. So instead of saying le computer, they say l'ordinateur. They came up with a French word for computer, which is the most French thing ever. Whereas in America, if like the Japanese invented like 3D, you know, sex dolls, and they called it I'm gonna get in trouble for this. Inoki Bambaye, we'd be like, well, you know, that's there. I go. That's the best I can do. We'd be like, all right, you know, a fucking good looking sex doll. Let's call it Inoki Bambaye.
You know. That if someone came to him with a big load of money and said, "Inoki, we want your image rights to brand this blow up doll, and we'll give you 5 freebie copies," he would take that deal in a heartbeat. Because that's the type of man that Inoki is.
And I would buy the next 5 fucking sex dolls from Japan and have my first orgy, and I'd be like, yeah, whatever, nobody come bother me in the hotel room. And then I would shoot them all in the head, because as an American, I have a gun. I don't actually have one, but maybe I will. Nah, I shouldn't.
Just on your point. I mean, there's a lot of truth to that. So the phrase you'd use is blood and soil nationalism, and the idea that, you know, people born in an area are the nation. And it is true that republics that have kind of a founding ideal can find it easier to assimilate people, because you kind of draw on this common conception. The French kind of do that. You know, the French are a republic. They do have a constitution. They do have a idea of what republican values are. What's interesting for Britain is you're right to a certain extent, in the sense of that, you know, England does feel incredibly rooted in a particular place. But obviously, England is one of a patchwork of identities involved in Britain. So what is fascinating in Britain is an awful lot of, you know, when you talk to, like, representatives of, say, the Muslim community and the black community or the Indian community, the natural inclination will not be to have a black Welsh representative or a Scottish Muslim representative. It will be, you know, black British, Muslim British, Indian British. Yeah. And the idea has been suggested that maybe because Britain is a patchwork identity linked to common adherence to certain institutions that for a lot of countries where most of our immigrants come from, such as Africa, Caribbean, India, those institutions were a part of those countries' lives, that it's easier to actually assimilate people into the identity of British, which, you know, by definition is both know, you are British, but you've also got a nationality as well. You know, so I am both British and English, whereas somebody in Scotland is both British and Scottish. So you can be both British and black, or both British and Muslim, or both British and Indian. And so I think Britain is doing better. The issue of European immigration was slightly different, because obviously a lot of people were coming temporarily. So the whole freedom of movement was a really weird experiment, because it was a combination of permanent immigration and a massive guest worker program. But I do think there's definitely something that it's easier for America to assimilate immigrants, because they have a republic and ideals, and you can tell people this story, and you can get people to buy into the story.
Yeah, and by the way, everybody listening, one of the things I always really thought was incredibly cool about you in particular, you wrote something once, because anyone listening is going to be like, holy shit, it's a bunch of more right-wing crazy shit. Could I Gavin McInnes, who's an amazing dude, but he's a crazy, you know, right-winger. And if I'm wrong, just say I'm wrong. It's fine. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But I believe I saw you once write, because you're, I will say, a socialist. I'll just say it in a very broad definition. And you essentially said, everybody in England is lying to the middle class when they say that you can only tax the rich. No, you can't just tax the rich. We all have to be in this together. And when you wrote that, I thought, wow, that's really honest. Because, you know, the leftists in America just want to pretend that the upper 1% of the world control everything and all this shit. But if you took all of their wealth, it wouldn't make a fucking dent in anything. The truth is that if you want true socialism, communism, blah, whatever, statism, that you have to essentially make everybody be involved in it. And I saw you write something kind of similar to that, and I'm like,
yeah, no.
It was really, really cool to me.
Yeah, so basically, it was partly inspired by so Jeremy Corbyn, who we should probably talk about at some point, but also Bernie Sanders in America. And these are guys who both predate Reagan. You know, they're both 70s radicals who have came back to prominence. And part of the reason they came back to prominence is that people of my age and younger who are left-wingers are angry at the compromises that Bill Clinton and Tony Blair made to get elected, and don't understand why they made those compromises. And one of the things I think a lot of people on the left of both our ages have fallen into the trap of is believing that the conservative tax cutting agenda was always a fraud. So today it kind of is, particularly in America, where, you know, you look at the tax cuts they're proposing. They really don't make much of a difference for an ordinary person's life, because they are so weighted to the rich. But you go back to Reagan and Thatcher, and they really were dramatically cutting people's taxes from very high levels. I mean, the stat I always use is, you know, look, today the tax I pay on my income, in terms of income tax, obviously pay other taxes as well, but in terms of income tax, I pay 20% of my income as tax. When I was born, my parents paid 33% of their income as tax. So that's a 13%, and it's actually more than a 13% decrease, because the tax-free amount has increased than the rate of inflation.
To interject here in America, and a lot of people don't know this, but until JFK was elected, the American income tax rate for the high earners was 90%. He lowered it to 70. Reagan lowered it to, I think, I want to say 28. And as a libertarian, you know, free market capitalist pig that I am, it totally worked. But when I saw your stuff, and I'm like, wow, it's somebody that on the left that will acknowledge, no, we're all in this together. You can't play class warfare and expect to win. you're going to lose money. Like, you're going to have your take-home pay. Even if you're a blue-collar guy working at a job in a fucking factory, you're going to lose some of your money. But at least in your defense, you would also say you will get a lot back in return. It all works out, and that's good for you. And
yeah, so that's exactly my answer. My argument would be is that, you know, when my parents were paying 33%, you know, they would have a more generous welfare state. So that was still at a point where the government was subsidizing a lot of factories to employ people. Things like Dole were worth more. So if you were employed, you'd get more support. If you wanted to go to university, you'd be given it for free. So all these sorts of things. And now, you know, say if you want to go to university, you have to pay. You have to pay some of that money back that is spent on your university. And the thing is, look, it's fine to want to change, so to go back to a more generous welfare state, or in case of Bernie Sanders in America, to have free healthcare paid for by the state. But there aren't enough rich people. That's the problem. There's just simply, in any society, there's not enough rich people to fund a mass welfare state. You have to get middle class people, and you even have to get working class people to pay a big proportion of that contribution. And what happened is you had this revolt against how high taxes had gotten in the 80s. And it led to decreased funding on the welfare state in both America and Britain. And what both Clinton and Blair did was, rather than try and push back against low taxes, I mean, Clinton increased taxes a bit, Blair hardly increased them at all. What they both did was say, well, we will keep taxes low, but rather than give everybody high cost welfare, we would just target it much more efficiently. And that's kind of but the problem is that really screws over young people, because young people tend to be the ones who have missed out on things in previous generations and may have gotten.
Yeah.
But they don't want to pay. I mean, there was a poll that showed that if you went to Bernie Sanders supporters and said, okay, so you really want this Medicare for all? And they're like, yeah, yeah, sure. Okay. If it increases your taxes by £1,000, you still want it? No.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. If I could go on a Bernie Sanders supporters, I'll fucking lose my mind. But they really are people that just – there's this idea within people, which is they're all victims, and they're not. Like, this is just the way the world is, and the fact is that there are people that make money and are successful, and guess what? Like, I don't make a lot of money. I'm not super successful. I haven't earned it. And there are people that have earned it, and they've made their way. And if I came together as a society and said, you know what? I think the way that we do things is good. I'll pay more towards it, and I'll make everybody happy. That's fine. But so many people seem to have this idea that they're being robbed and ripped off or whatever. And it's like, nah. You know, I have this working bit in my head when I one day do stand-up comedy, which is everybody always jokes about the 5% or whatever controlling everything. It's like, look around at all the people that you know in life. Do you know a lot of smart people that should be running their lives? No. Most people are stupid and they need to be guided. There's a lot of really dumb people out there in the world, and you know, and everybody thinks that they're smart. Everybody thinks that they are the smartest person in the room, and they're not. And when I read all of your stuff, I'm like, wow, it's refreshing to read somebody that says, no, this is not an instance where, you know, the upper crust are screwing us all over. All of us are in this together. We all need to just accept that we will all give more for something better. Whether that actually comes to be, whether that actually pans out, is a different matter, a totally different discussion. It's a philosophical and, you know, economical disagreement. But you had this incredible honesty, which I don't see out of a lot of left of center people, because they all want to just be like, no. All everybody else, your life will be just the same. We'll just take money from 5 rich people, and you'll be totally okay. And you'll have a bigger house, a bigger car, and all the free healthcare you want. And Bill Gates will still keep making computers.
Well, I think that was the whole article actually said that. So this was about Jeremy Corbyn at Labour, and he was just saying, look, this guy knows his program isn't popular. He knows that, so he was like Bernie Sanders, fudging the maths. He was fudging how he was going to pay for everything, by saying he was going to tax the banks more and tax rich people more. And the thing is, someone like Hillary Clinton can just about get away with saying we're just going to tax the rich more,
yeah,
because she wants to make such incremental differences. So she can say this very, very small thing I'm going to do. I'll go and get the banks to pay a little bit more tax, and that will fund this extension of paid maternity leave, for example.
Right.
But when you want to do something really radical, you have to broaden your tax base. You can't do a $6 trillion takeover of healthcare and not increase people's taxes. And the thing is, look, it would be better if you could make it work, which is another question, but if you could make it work, it would be better to tax people a bit more and deliver state healthcare. You know, it would be cheaper. You know, it'd be cheaper, it'd be more efficient. People wouldn't have to worry about not being covered. It means people wouldn't be trapped in jobs they don't like because they can't risk to lose their healthcare. But it would cost money. You would have to pay more in taxes. And I understand why left-wingers... Again, I think there's two people. There are young people who say stuff like this because they don't realize how high the income tax rate really used to be.
Right.
And they don't realize just how much people are being asked to pay at one point. But there is also just the fact that people like Bernie Sanders who do know are just choosing not to say.
And that's really telling because I know that you're married. I don't know if you have kids. Do you have children?
Yeah, we have kids.
Oh, wow. There's an old expression. If you're 20 years old and you don't vote Democrat, you don't have a heart. If you're 40 years old and you don't vote Republican, you don't have a brain. And I kind of have this sense with, seeing some of the stuff you've written where, like, over time you're like, yeah, guys, if we all do this, it works. But otherwise, all you're going to do is punish people that actually produce something. And
well, that's not so much my thing. I mean, I don't really worry about being mean to the rich. I probably would have quite high marginal tax rates, because one of the things you have to remember is a lot of the marginal tax rates that both America and Britain had weren't about raising revenue. It was a way of stopping people earning a lot of money. So like that 90% tax band, that was there to stop people earning above that amount, because, why bother? Now, why bother going and arguing to the board of directors to get this extra
right
10-20 grand pay rise when you know the government's going to confiscate it off you anyway? You might as well spend that 20 grand on giving your workers a raise so they do more. But my thing is, so I work at a university, and so I have a lot of familiarity with how we pay for universities, and this has been a massive bone of contention in terms of a lot of people think we should fund higher education through general taxation. So, people pay their taxes.
For the record, no. As someone that went through a lot of higher education, no one should ever go to university or college. It's a fucking scam. Go to fucking trade school. Learn to be a plumber. You'll make a lot more money, and you won't have all this fucking debt like dipshit Mike does, the lawyer. Ugh. Anyways, go on.
So a lot of people say fund it through taxation. And that used to be the case in Britain until mid-90s. So now we have tuition fees. Now, they aren't like America, thank God. They're kind of like what Hillary Clinton would like to create, which is basically there is a tuition fee, but a government forwards you a loan to cover that tuition fee. Give you a loan to cover your living costs.
No. That loan is bullshit. That will follow me for the rest of my fucking life. At the age of 18, somebody thought it'd be okay to give me the equivalent of a fucking mortgage. Fuck you, people. That's bullshit. I was stupid. All I wanted to do was buy Sandman and Preacher comic books. And I had no idea what I was doing. And I graduated in 4 years. I did law school in 3 years. I did all right. And I have all this debt. And, fuck you guys. Because I was too stupid to know what I was doing. I just bought pita, pitas with chicken from the pita pit and comic books. Anyways, go on.
So here are our tuition fee loan terms. So this is what everybody in Britain is moaning about, it being so unreasonable and unfair, okay? If you can't pay it off within 30 years, it's written off by the government. So you have 30 years after graduation to pay it. If you can't pay it within 30 years, don't worry about it. The government will write it off.
What? What the fuck? No! Oh, fucking hell! I would fucking give anything. I get my fucking left nut, which is probably not working anymore for 30 years. I'd be my fifth. Oh, fuck you guys. All right, go on.
Okay. So, it's the interest rate is either the rate of inflation, so effectively zero in real terms, or it is up to 3% maximum above inflation, depending on how much money you're earning. Your repayment is 9% of your annual income above the equivalent American dollars of probably around about $35,000-$40,000. If you're earning less, you don't pay anything. If you're earning nothing, you don't pay anything. Whilst all the time remembering that you have this 30-year window to pay it all.
I hate you. I hate your entire... I hate your entire country. God bless America. The 4th of July, when I will publish this. Everybody remember Two of by Lantern or One of by Sea or whatever the fuck Paul Revere did. We put the tea in the Boston Harbor or whatever the fuck it is. It's the... God damn it, the fuck? Why am I getting fucked so bad? Damn it!
So my thing has been, I actually did the opposite. So I was one of these weird people who has moved to the left as I've gotten older. My thing has been is, look, okay, so effectively what I've got is a 9% increase in my income tax. I mean, because it's a government program. It's not even like I have to have a direct debit set up. It's literally taken out of my paycheck by the government. It is part of my income tax. So I've got a 9% surcharge, right? So I'm effectively paying a bit under 29% because it's not all of my taxable income that's having this 9% taken off. But my parents were paying 33% when I was born. So that just shows you that, back then, if I'd gone to university, I'd have gotten it free. But it then came out and paid 33% income tax. Yeah, okay, I've had to pay my tuition fees, but I'm only paying 25, 26% of my income. So I'm ahead of the game still. And I think this is what a lot of young people are like, when our parents got to go to university. It's like, yes, but they then had to pay 33%, 40% of their income as taxes. That's the difference.
Well,
you're still in shock about the tuition, about the student loan system.
Actually, I have to take a piss really bad, but it's really awful. One of the things, and I don't know if we talked about it on the last show, I talked about it with somebody. I saw this statistic that said that, and this is a total non sequitur. Oh yeah, that's right, people. I know Latin. That of the Muslims in England, that 52% of all Muslims living in England want to make homosexuality illegal.
Yeah, we did speak about this. Yeah, we covered this one.
Oh, fuck. All right. Well, fuck it then. fuck the Muslims.
Let me talk about Jeremy Corbyn, because this is a good one.
All right. Talk about him. Don't stop until you hear me again. I'm going to go to the pisser and just keep going.
Okay. So, Jeremy Corbyn, whilst Mike's at the toilet, he is the leader of the Labour Party, and he was elected despite having no MP support on him, and he's had a really bad week, because so in Britain, our opposition is meant to form what's called a shadow cabinet. That literally takes every single government minister position, appoints a opposition spokesman to kind of look at what they're doing and saying, that's a bad job, we could be doing that better. And he had, at the start of the week, he had about 80 people on his shadow cabinet. About 60 of them have resigned, including some of the people he appointed to replace the people that were resigning. It's gone to the point that he's having to rope in 80-year-old veteran socialists that have been like lifelong backbenchers, because he's just running out of bodies. And this has all started because basically all the MPs, except the very hardcore people who agree with him, are desperate for him to go. Partly because they thought there may be an early election, which doesn't look likely now. And they keep trying to quit to force him to basically give it up and just let them take the party back. What's making this even better is, despite is that the party then arranged to have a vote of no confidence in his leadership, of the members of parliament who are Labour, which is around about 259, 80% of his MPs said that they do not have confidence in their leader. He turned around and said, yeah, I'm still not going. So he's had, you know, literally four-fifths of his front bench, his shadow cabinet, quit on him. He's had 80% of his parliamentary party express no confidence in him.
I'm back,
by the way. Oh, good. Yeah. And he's still not going, Mike. He's still not going. So basically, I was just saying about Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, Jeremy Corbyn is not going. He has a what the fuck is a shadow cabinet? Is that like a real thing?
I was explaining this. So basically, what happens is the opposition is meant to appoint people to shadow each government's position. And it is literally somebody to look at what the government minister is doing and say, that's a bit shit. You could do this a bit better.
So it's basically in America, like if the Republicans had like the Secretary of Treasury, the Democrats would have like the shadow Secretary of Treasury, watch what they're doing. Oh, that makes so much sense, because like when I hear like shadow government, I'm like, that sounds really kind of like insidious. Like, you have like this hidden government organization that does things. I'm not lying when I say that's what I thought it was. I'm like, why do they even talk about that? It's like the CIA talking about all the shit that they're doing and investigating people overseas, which, for the record, when everybody's like, oh, the CIA has spies inside of Britain, it's like, yeah? You think Britain doesn't have spies inside of us? Like, that's what we do. We may like each other, but we're still different countries. So, alright, I'll let you go on, even though I feel so much better right now, having gotten to release myself.
So basically what I was saying is that his shadow cabinet, about 60 of the 80 people he had in his shadow cabinet have quit, including some of the people he appointed to replace the people that had quit. He's had a vote of no confidence passed against him by 80% of his parliamentary party. This is Jeremy Corbyn.
Okay.
Unfortunately, they forgot to put in a mechanism for the MPs to get rid of a leader they didn't like. So even though his shadow cabinet has all quit, even though his parliamentary party has expressed no confidence in him, he is still refusing to go. And there's nothing they can do other than force a leadership challenge, which will throw the vote over to the party members, who all indications show would just re-elect him. And it's getting even better. So isolated has Jeremy Corbyn became that his aides are now refusing to let him meet Shadow Cabinet members for fear that they might bully him to quit?
Wow.
So the deputy leader is desperately trying to get a meeting with his leader, and he's being told no, and the literal, no, on the record is, Jeremy Corbyn is an old man. We have a duty of care. We will not let Tom Watson bully him.
Wait, MMA fighter Tom Watson?
No. Oh. Tom Watson is the MP, deputy leader of the Labour Party.
Oh, wait. So
you're thinking of Tom Lord? Yeah, go on. Oh yeah, Tom Watson.
Tom.
I never made that link. Yeah, no, he's not that Tom Watson.
Tom Kong Watson is who I'm thinking of.
Tom Kong.
So basically, the two major leaders, the biggest public figures in the parliamentary British politics are Jeremy Corbyn and David Cameron, and both of them, Corbyn is not liked by his constituency. Cameron has admitted to himself and to everybody else of, yeah, no one likes me. Is there anyone in Britain that the British people like?
No.
That's not a good answer. You gotta have somebody. Like, should we bring Donald Trump over? I'm sure he'll take over England if you give him a chance. Like, I'll do it. I'll take over the country. I'm pretty good. Like, I'll just drink a lot and, you know, try to have sex with Kate Middleton, and she'll totally want that American dick because I'm not balding.
Probably Cameron is probably the most popular politician. I mean, amongst his people who like it, because this is a weird thing with Cameron. He got defeated by a real ragtag coalition, but he's probably the prime minister, the politician most best positioned to win an election. Boris Johnson is a fairly popular politician as well. Obviously, he's out of the running. None of the candidates with his Tory leadership are particularly popular or well known. I mean, Theresa May has been a fairly anonymous Home Secretary. On the Labour side, they're all non-entities. If there was any popular politician on Labour, they'd have never have lost to Jeremy Corbyn in the first place.
So, is Jeremy Corbyn, in American terms, is he more Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders?
Oh, he's like full fat Bernie Sanders. He's Bernie Sanders when the cameras aren't on, and he doesn't have to pretend to be sane. So to give you an example of the type of man Jeremy Corbyn is. So Jeremy Corbyn had to deliver a speech on Thursday, and the speech was about an inquiry into the fact that Labour Party had been accused of having problems with anti-Semitism. And one of the recommendations of this report was that Labour Party members must stop making unhelpful comparisons between Israel and Nazi Germany, other bad things. What does Jeremy Corbyn do? He stands up and says, "We can no more blame our Jewish friends for the actions of Israel than we could blame our Muslim friends for the actions of so-called Islamic states." And I was just like, what are you doing?
What
are you doing? You can't just compare Israel to Islamic State. Are you mad?
He said that fucking Israel is basically the modern day Nazi party?
Well, no, other people did. So this was an inquiry into the fact that other people have been saying this. And he then managed to compare Israel to Islamic State. And people were just like, you can't help yourself. The thing is, problem with Corbyn is he's been, and since he's been leader, he's been very vague about what he actually believes in.
Right.
But you know, from what he's talked about in the past, you know, it's benign agendas. You know, it would be very high taxes for the rich, mass public spending, printing money to fund investment in the economy.
Your standard left wing politician of tax the rich, give money to the poor, fuck the banks, and all those people will make everything, you know. Communism without actually saying the word communism in a very, very simplistic way.
Yeah, would be some national. The big difference is obviously, is being honest about printing money. So, you know, they've kind of repackaged it as talking about people's quantitative easing. So whereas we have quantitative easing to give money to the banks, well, we just print money off and we use it to fund industrial expansion. But the problem is, you know, this is the same with Bernie Sanders. I don't mean to make fun of Bernie Sanders.
No, it's fine, because quantitative easing is, in my opinion, it doesn't make any sense. Like, you can't just print money, give it to people, and think, oh, yeah, that'll solve everything. Like, no, economies are complex. Sometimes businesses fail. Sometimes they go up. If you don't like the, you know, traditional Adam Smith capitalism, that's fine. If you want to move more towards a Marxist style of government, also fine. But just admit it and say the government needs to be running these things. But it seems to me like that middle ground where, like, oh, no, we love GM and Chrysler or Jaguar in England, so we'll give them the public's money, but we'll let them have the idea of the public is responsible for the losses and the private collects all of the gains, which is, terrible perversion of both systems.
I think COVID would solve that problem. Rolls-Royce was once government-owned. Rolls-Royce was once nationalized back in the 70s. We and the British government used to own a travel agent.
The what?
So it used to be, America. What do you call a shop you buy holidays from?
Travel agents being the people that would set, like...
Sell you the holiday. You go into a shop and...
Yeah, they plan your entire holiday vacation. Yeah. Like, oh, okay, you'll pay $200 for airfare, here's your hotel.
Yeah.
And you get your all-exclusive pass to Disney World for $50.
Yeah. Yeah, the British government used to own one of those.
Why the fuck would they own that?
Well, it was going out of business, and it was like, well, we want to save the people's jobs. And so the government just bought it.
But they fucking just do nothing basically people have the ability to go on vacation or holiday. Like, that's not like steel workers. This is people that are like, whose job is to make people have like 2 good weeks in bullshit Disney World where they paid to have their kid get molested by Mickey Mouse. What the fuck?
The problem I have with people like Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn is it is very much the fumes of pre-Thatcherite, Reaganite socialism, in the sense of that they haven't fought... It's the old Colbert joke about George W. Bush, you know. George W. Bush thinks the same thing on Wednesday as he did on Monday, no matter what happened Tuesday. Well, these guys kind of think the same thing today that they did in the 70s, regardless of what happened in the 80s, 90s, and noughties. And, you know, the world has just changed an awful lot. What people would accept has changed an awful lot. What people want has changed an awful lot. And they haven't thought through how they're going to change their policy offer to meet these new realities, and that gives you quite a disappointing I've just got what downstairs.
Finish the sentence before I go on a rant. It's good.
it gives you quite bitty, unsatisfying policy offers. So it's like Bernie Sanders. So it's like he talks of Medicare for all, but the minute you actually look into the detail, it's more of a slogan than a policy, because he hasn't thought for. So okay, Medicare for all is a classic example. It is true that the British style healthcare system is cheaper than the American style. It's cheaper because we tell people, no, that miracle cure you've read in the magazine is shit. It won't work. It's too expensive. We're not giving it to you. No, you don't have cancer. That's back acne. We're not putting you through massive expensive tests. Bernie Sanders, and so, you know, it is the old Sarah Palin line of death panels, you know, not kind of as scary as she makes it sound, but is basically allowing government bureaucrats to sit there and say, no, sorry, you can't have that. That's where the savings come from. Bernie Sanders says, we'll have this state-funded healthcare, and you'll get whatever you want. There'll be no one to say no to you.
Right.
But somehow it'll be magically cheap. And it's like, well, no, that doesn't work. You haven't thought it through.
It's basically someone that ignores the problem of classical communism, which is the free rider. And they don't want to just admit that there will be people who will take advantage of it. And I'm one of those people, everybody. Like, if I had free healthcare, if I could just walk in the hospital, have a test every day, I'd be in there every single day gaming the system for pain pills or whatever it is. But it's like they ignore it's kind of like the, you know, European Union with Greece, where, like, Greece didn't want to, like, do the right thing, and Germany's like, wait a second, we're doing it right, and France is like, we're kind of doing it right, and England's like, yeah, we're doing it right, but we're gonna leave. And, you know, there is always going to be, it seems, in any kind of collective system of ruling, whether it's government or whatever, people don't want to acknowledge the free rider, and it's fine. You know what? Maybe it's better for society as a whole. Maybe we are all better off if we allow the free riders to manipulate the system and take advantage of it, and there are just going to be, you know, crackheads and people like me, who would probably turn to crack if I could, who will, you know, take advantage of the system. But you know what? It works for the rest of us. But it seems like on the left, there's this desire to, you know, almost deny that these people would exist. They want to be like, no, everybody will be good, we'll all, you know, be responsible, but that's just not how the human condition works.
I think the weird thing is you have this two impulses. So it's quite odd when you see some of the people in America now calling themselves socialists, because socialism is very statist. It's very authoritarian in many, many ways. And, you know, you look at the socialist governments in Britain. They were incredibly authoritarian in terms of how they took control of the economy, took control of certain key services, and had the state deliver them. And the hype in individualism that most young people have, whether they're right or left, is kind of incompatible with socialist economics. You can't go around saying, I am in charge of my own life. If you are going to submit to the government, you know, buying your schooling, buying your healthcare, you know, taking money to determine your investments, preparing for your pension, you are giving up an incredible amount of your economic freedom, in the hope being that it will give you economic security.
Yeah.
I'm not sure people who back Bernie Sanders really quite get what he's offering them.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that, because, again, not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that, but they don't want to admit it. They think they have this all-encompassing idea that they can do whatever they want and still be taken care of. And meanwhile, like, especially when it comes to healthcare, I know the Britons are very, very proud and protective of the NHS, and in America, we're just kind of starting to have that, and a lot of British people are like, well, why? How uncivilized is America? You don't have, you know, nationalized healthcare. But it's like, the moment that all of us are responsible for someone else's health gives me an incentive to say, hey, fat guy down the street, no more, mega gulps from, big gulps from 7-Eleven. And nobody wants to think of that. We want to think that we can do whatever we want and it'll be okay, we'll be taken care of. But no, you can't. If you want to have nationalized healthcare, which maybe it's a good thing, maybe that's the way to go, you're also going to accept that the government will tell you, You can't have this many trans fats. You can't go to McDonald's 12 times a day. You have to weigh less than 200 pounds. And the sad thing is, like, that's probably best for everyone. But we all, I think, as, again, especially that Anglo-Western mindset, more in America maybe than even in England, of that frontierism where, you know, America, we're all cowboys. And we're proud to be cowboys. Like, every American, I think, has that cowboy instinct of, I will just get on my horse, I will walk to the west, I'll set up shop, and I'll just do my thing, and no one will bug me. Like, that's almost a very uniquely American attitude towards life. But you can't have that while also having the idea of, oh, yeah, but, you know, if I have diabetes because I had too many Krispy Kreme donuts, yeah, the government takes care of me.
Well, I think the thing is, you're right in the sense of, you know, you look in Britain, that the government does pump a lot of things out about being healthy. The one thing people have to remember is that Britain is, you know, America was extreme for not having a universal socialized healthcare system. I mean, people have to remember, America does have a lot of public healthcare. You know, it has Medicare, has Medicaid. You know, it has veterans healthcare. You know, a lot of people get government funded healthcare in America.
Mm-hmm.
But Britain is at the other extreme, because Britain doesn't just have a system where the government pays for healthcare. Britain has a system where the government provides healthcare. So you look at Canada, you look at France, you look at Germany, they have systems where the government is effectively the insurance company. They are the people paying the doctors, paying the hospitals. But the doctors and hospitals are, in a lot of cases, still private companies or private individuals.
Right.
In Britain, you know, the NHS, National Health Service, is run by the government. Every hospital is owned by the government. Every doctor, every nurse, every midwife has a contract with the government. The government has a body that determines which drugs it will allow to be distributed through hospitals. It's, you know, it is a Stalinist system. Set up an immediate aftermath of the Second World War, when there was a great faith in state war planning. And here's the thing, right? It is awesome at not spending a lot of money on healthcare. So America spends 17-18% of GDP on healthcare. Britain spends 9% at most.
America, pretty. I think we spend per capita about $8,000 every year on healthcare per citizen, which I think is second only like Sweden. But Sweden's not a real country because there are like five people that live there and no one cares about them.
So, but what it does mean is you have the government engaging in rationing. So, you know, you have waiting lists. So, you know, you may have to wait a while to get your operation. You have doctors not being paid as much as in America. So here's one of the things. People wonder why America doesn't have socialized healthcare, or why the doctors are so leery about any forms of socialized healthcare. It's because they can see what happens in other countries. They see, like, for example, the government literally imposed a contract on our doctors because they threatened to go on strike because they didn't like the contract terms being offered. That's the type of power the government has for the NHS. Now, look, I'm a big defender of the NHS. I think it's a very sensible system. It's a very efficient system.
Right.
But it is that thing of, you trade that freedom, to trade the freedom to, because in theory, no, we do have private hospitals, but the reality is because people already pay X amount in taxes to fund the NHS, most people go to the NHS. It's only relatively wealthy people,
right,
who will go to a private hospital. So you don't get to pick your doctor. You don't get to pick the hospital you go to. But you don't have to pay for it. So is giving up that choice worth having the security that you know no matter what happens, no matter what your income situation is, you can go to the doctor? Now, I'd say, yeah, fuck it. I don't know how to pick a doctor. I'd much rather just let the government allocate me one. Yeah. I don't have to pay for it. I don't have to worry. Other people may have a different opinion, but, you know, it to me, it's a more efficient system. But yeah, but The thing is, America could never have that system because it would be so difficult to create. We got there before healthcare was a big industry. And so we were basically taking over a charitable sector, whereas America would have massive corporations trying to stop it.
Well, it's funny because I don't know who I was talking to, but I feel like there's this – people do not understand the fact that America is 300 million people, five times the size of Great Britain. And we're half of the current European Union, but basically the size of the modern Western Europe. And, like, we're just different. You go to California or Alabama, the people aren't the same. And to have one unified policy for everyone is almost impossible. And in America, we say, like, states' rights, and people go, shit, that means you're a racist. Uh-oh. And nobody wants to say it. But, again, our states are like the countries in Europe. You can literally go from France to Germany in about 40 minutes, and it's completely different. If I go from Illinois to, Indiana, it's the same fucking people. And it seems like we don't want to acknowledge the fact that we're just almost too big to have something universal for everyone. Whereas, like, if you're in Norway, people like always say, oh, Norway has 6 million people. And look at them. They have nationalized healthcare and everything works. Like, yeah, it's 6 million people that are 100% homogenized. America's 300 million people, 50 times as big, and we have English, Irish, Scots, Mexican, Hispanic, Black, whatever it is, like, and those cultures have not all coalesced into one unified identity, which is great for America. By the way, July 4th, Independence Day, fuck you, Britain, we beat your ass, but it's like nobody wants to say we're just too big.
This is one thing. I mean, I mentioned the anti-federalists when we were talking a couple of weeks ago, and it's one of the things I'm a fairly big believer in that you can have a country that's too big. In the sense of that if a country gets too big, both the vested interests that exist in any country get so big, they achieve a critical mass that they can overwhelm the government. But also, and this is what we didn't talk about, is that democracy does rest on a shared of national identity. And this is one of the things I get very annoyed about with liberals in this in Britain, is that you get a lot of people who say, it makes no sense to be proud of your country because it's an accident of birth.
Right.
And look, I'm as critical of Britain's past as anybody. Britain's got a past now. No, it's got some very good points in it. It's got a lot of bad points as well. But if you really believe your nationality is not important, it's just an accident of birth, then how do you justify a welfare state? Because, there has to be some feeling of shared identity that, the person in Liverpool is part of a community with me, even though we will never meet, never even be in the same city together. Right. That justifies my taxes going to fund their healthcare and his taxes going to fund my children's education. And that has to be national identity. And this is where big countries fall down. And this is why big countries countries that have more diverse populations tend to have less extensive welfare states. Because if you don't have that common sense of identity, it's far more difficult to justify to people why their taxes go to support things for strangers.
It's funny, especially when you just said, diverse cultures within the country. And again, being released on 4th of July, I don't know if there's any other country on the planet that quite has what America has. Whereas, you look at China has 1 billion people, but they are, for the most part, Chinese. Yes, there's some Mongols and the people in Guangzhou, a little different people in Songhai versus Beijing or Peking, but it's basically the Chinese culture. Whereas you come to America and we are the legitimate melting pot. We have some common ideas, but the most common idea is basically, freedom. And I think we talked about it earlier, whereas if you go to France, there's a Frenchman. You know what a Frenchman is. You know what an Italian person looks like. You know what a Swedish person looks like. Like, instinctively, like if you say, what does an Italian look like, you'd be like, black hair, they live with their parents into the 30s, they like pasta and things like this. And it's a little oversimplified, but it's true. For the most part, whereas you go, what does a Swedish person look like? 6'4", named Thor, and they hit people with hammers, and they eliminate people from England from the Euros.
Well, but this is the thing, because this is where things are interesting, because a lot of the generalizations you can make about Europe, you do have to say except Britain and France, because Britain and France aren't just European countries, that they are former world powers. So Britain
former.
And France...
I just said former, just to put a little dig. This is coming on the Independence Day, America. Go watch Will Smith say, "Welcome to Earth," and punch an alien. But yeah, go ahead.
So we're former world powers. And so, you know, both countries have large populations that, you know, either are directly from or can trace their, or have relatives or ancestors from countries they used to run. So, you know, France, it would be the Middle East, Northern Africa. Don't think there's many people from Southeast Asia. That's a country the French used to rule in Southeast Asia. I can't remember what it was called.
Vietnam?
Do you remember? Yeah, that... Has any Americans ever been to Vietnam? How did they find it?
We... kind of started. We might have started a bit of a war there, but there is some.
You didn't start it. You got tricked by the French.
We did that because they had their sexy French accents. We're like, yes, I will go to your and fight in Asia for you, you sexy French bastard. Thank you, Charles de Gaulle.
You talk about Iceland having some great victories. I mean, the run of form the Vietnamese had in terms of war was amazing. They beat the French, then they beat the Americans.
No, they didn't beat us. We would have won that war if we wanted to. We gave them that one. America doesn't lose wars. Back to back World War champions as America, motherfuckers. We won World War I, World War II, and those the gooks, as they called them. I don't even know what the fuck gooks means. I have no idea why that's a slur. But we would have beat you in Vietnam if we really wanted to.
And then it'd be China.
Well, China is a bunch of pussies.
Then they beat China. So they literally, you know, they just was on this incredible run of form in terms of war.
They didn't beat anybody else, though. Just America and China. Oh, shit.
And France.
And France. Although, I will say this, and I think I talked to you last time, and you didn't really know him, but Milo Yiannopoulos, he confirmed a theory of mine. I really do believe that the British don't get enough credit for what they have done in history. And that is, if you look at every single former British colony, they are the best places on earth. America, Canada, Australia, Hong Kong, India. Every place that Britain went, they did not rape and pillage the land. They left behind... you know, democracy, you know, rationality.
Unfortunately, you kind of stopped the list quite, because we run a lot of countries. So, you know,
South Africa. South Africa is better than any place in in Africa. Whereas if you look at
Zimbabwe was governed by us, Zambia, Egypt.
But here's the thing. But if you compare that to what France and Portugal and Spain did, none of their former colonies are better off. Every single major country on the planet that is good, that fights for, you know, the rights of people, that improves things, that wants to help the poor and all that, are all basically founded on the British Commonwealth system of government.
It's a funny one, because it's weird that Spain, Portugal, and because really, I think the key thing for us was the settler colonies, so Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and America. They're the ones you can really point to and say these are very well run countries.
Hong Kong.
Well, Hong Kong's a really weird one because Hong Kong's it's kind of Hong Kong, but
I can say Hong Kong just because I've been there several times and they love England, they hate China, they know exactly, they know that England is responsible for basically their entire
existence. Singapore. But in terms of then obviously for Portugal and Spain, you have the same thing in Latin America, places like Brazil and Argentina.
Right.
But France never did that. It's not like you have, with the exception of Quebec, settler colonies.
No, Africa, France.
What I meant is in terms of, Britain and France and other European countries, ran countries all over Asia and Africa and the Caribbean. But what made places like America and Canada unique is that basically you had this massive wave of emigration. It was like a mass form of colonization where literally a bunch of Europeans rocked up and just supplanted the population. Hello.
I'm here.
Soon. Sorry, my wife just came in to say hi.
Oh, put her on the phone. I'll talk to her too. Yeah. Oh, put your wife on the phone because I know that she's black. I don't know what you do. You guys say like English African or African England or what? What's the term you use?
Well, her name's been behind.
Well, because in America, I remember one time and I fucking laughed my ass off at some woman on CNN. She said, the African American French people. I'm like, you can't just say black. You have to like say African American French. That doesn't exist. They're fucking just black people in France. It's okay. Don't be so sensitive.
Yeah, she'd be black British.
Put her on the phone.
Well, she's gone now. She's gone to the baby.
Oh no! You take care of the baby. Oh, I want her on the phone so bad. That'll be amazing.
No. You would not want to be on the phone.
You fucking sensible bastard! You're ruining great podcasting. She'd be amazing. I had a dude once, on the phone. He put his wife on the phone, and I got him to admit that his wife would take it in the ass to save the marriage. So I'm just saying, I'm good with women. You might get something out of this. Anyways, going back to British exceptionalism and how they've made the world better.
It's a weird one, really, because obviously, I've been to Caribbean quite a bit, and a lot of British culture is still there. But at the end of the day, colonialism is wrong. It is wrong to go into somebody else's country and steal it. I think British people don't appreciate just how much hurt that caused. So, look, I mean, we can talk about America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, but at the end of the day, these are countries where the British people went to those countries, wiped out everybody who was already there, set up shop and thought, you know what, this country's pretty awesome. Other countries, it was a much more mixed situation. You know, in a lot of countries, particularly places in Africa, Britain went in, destabilized what was already there, and what they put in place didn't stick, and so led to instability. And you had the fact that we just stole a bunch of stuff from people, which is, you know, one of the reasons why a certain country kicked us out on the 4th of July.
Would that be, is that Zimbabwe? No.
No, that would be America.
Oh, well, no, I was actually looking at it. The Dutch celebrate the 4th of July. The Philippines celebrate the 4th of July because America left them. And there's a country in Africa that it's a shitty one now, but it was good at the time. But it's a very weird quirk where, as Westerners, you know, and all of us, you, me, and everybody, we are, I would say, classically liberal. Forget Marxism. We're just classically liberal, like, we don't want to impose our culture on other people. And yet, we look back at our shame. You know, Britain has, you know, they look and they say, oh, what we did to the Aborigines in Australia, or what we did to the Africans in South Africa, or the Native Americans in America. And yet, conversely, America, Britain in particular, are so determined to allow mass immigration within our own cultures, which is almost like we're paying penance. Like, we went into other countries and we thought, it's not right for us to do this. We shouldn't have done it. We're sorry. But we will allow in America, Mexicans in Britain, I think it's Polish people, to come in and kind of subvert that culture. It's almost like we're allowing ourselves to, you know, die on the cross for our past sins. But it doesn't make any sense, because we know that what we did was wrong, and therefore what they're doing is also wrong, but we don't want to say that what they're doing is wrong.
I think it's difficult. I think I wouldn't agree with that. I think in Britain, so African, Caribbean, Asian immigration was because of the bonds that have been built by Britain. So the old joke Lenny Henry, a black British comedian, would say is, I'm over here because you were over there. But you have to remember is that it wasn't just a case of a load of British guys being there taking the land. You know, Britain ran everything. So, you know, you look at the West Indies, as late as the 50s, everything in places like Jamaica was run by white people. Or Indians that the white people had brought over,
right,
to help run the country. And the British taught people that Britain is, no, the phrase was the mother country. No, Britain is wonderful. It is great. You are lucky to be run by Britain. You should be grateful for Britain, all the nice things Britain does for you. And so, you know, it made sense for a lot of these people to come to Britain and to try and build a new life for themselves after the Second World War. And again, a lot of the shared culture you need to be able to have that sense of nationhood, a lot of that Britain went through with its former colonies. So you look at the Somme, Battle of Somme, biggest battle in the First World War. You know, there were black and Asian soldiers from the colonies on the fields of the Somme. There were lots of Indians, lots of Africans, lots of people from Caribbean who fought in the First World War, fought in the Second World War. And so a British culture, a pan-British empire culture was formed, maybe by accident, maybe on purpose. And so I think that allows an immigration to happen in a way that isn't threatening. In America, obviously, I think it is probably more similar to what we've had recently with Eastern Europe, which is the system's been allowed to just completely collapse in the sense of no one really knows what the plan is. So you just basically have a part of the world that is very economically prosperous, that is pulling people in to do jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not much thought being put out about how this will happen. But even America, Arizona's a good example. So Arizona has a long-standing Mexican population because it used to be part of Mexico. So, have people.
Well, yeah.
So one of the, I was reading this, one of the hilarious things about Arizona is you're having all these people from other American states move to Arizona because Arizona's got a slightly thriving economy and it's nice and warm if you want to retire.
Oh, and baseball out the fucking ass and spring training. I love you, Arizona. I would move to you in a second. Go ahead.
But so you're having all these northeastern seaboard or southern transplants rock up in Arizona, see these Mexicans and think, what are these fucking immigrants doing here? But yet not realizing they're the immigrants. These are these Mexican communities have been there since Arizona has ever existed. And I think that is one thing. You play things like places like Texas, places like California, places like Arizona. Places like, certain extent, even parts of Florida, the patterns of immigration are just a reflection of natural cultural ties that kind of cross the Mexican, American boundary or the American Caribbean boundary.
This is getting really smart all of a sudden. This is,
what's it?
No, I'm not going to lie. Like, I live in my bubble, and I don't want to pretend that I'm dumb, but I don't get to talk about, real issues like this a lot. Like, I just pop some fucking bubble wrap because I'm bored. But it's interesting because, again, you're, more or less a proud, we'll say leftist, but you're very honest about where you're coming from. And I say this as someone that is a very clear rightist, a libertarian, and yet it does seem like there's this new alignment where people, I'll say the extreme right and the extreme left, which I don't really know what that means. I think extreme is just a phrase people use for they disagree with what I stand with. It's like, oh, you don't think you should have abortion ever? You're extreme. You think you should have abortion whenever? You're extreme. It's like, really? Like, there's like tens of millions of people. Like, I hate when people are like, Donald Trump supporters are extreme. It's like, no, that's at least 25 to 40% of the population. Even if he loses, that's a lot of people. Maybe you should acknowledge that the people in Wyoming and South Dakota have differences and grievances that are, and go with it. And yet, again, we have this realignment where the extremes on both sides have this, like, the similar desired outcome, but we don't have the similar desired method of getting there. Like, we all want the same thing. Whereas on the left, they think we have state control, that'll make things happen, and that'll work. And on the right, we think if you don't have the state control, you let people do what they're going to do, it'll work. But we both pretty much want the same outcome. And it's really just these dumbasses in the center. Everybody thinks that the centrists are the right ones, but maybe they're not. Because they don't really know what they want. They just think, oh, maybe a little of this, a little of that. And that's why we have, government supporting corporations and bailing them out. And if you're a leftist, you think that's, if you're a true, leftist, you think that's not good. A government should not give money to General Motors. And as a libertarian rightist, you think the government should not give money to General Motors. Like, it's very, very simple. Like, we're all kind of on the same page, but if you're in the middle, you think, well, we want to kind of keep things the way they are so that people in Detroit have jobs.
Well, I think that's the key thing. I think it's the people, the centrists, the people running the countries, because they're actually running the country, their policies become far more muddled. So, yeah, so me as a socialist, you as a libertarian, we can shoot the shit, we can talk about things, and we can, you know, we can talk about what we want to do in an ideal world. Now, who knows what Hillary Clinton wants to do in an ideal world? I'm not even sure she knows anymore.
She wants to fucking take it all over, burn it to the ground, and make herself queen. But, yeah.
I hate her. But when you are in charge, or think you might be in charge, that does tend to make you a more convoluted, tortured person, because you're just kind of thinking, well, I would like, and particularly in America, because it's so difficult to get things done in your system.
Yep.
You know, it's like, oh, well, I want to do this, but I can't do that, so I'll do this instead. I mean, look, Obamacare is a classic example of this. Everyone knows Obamacare isn't as good as it should be, because the Democrats purposely put stuff in that they knew was bad as an attempt to force the Republicans to do a deal. The Republicans refused to do a deal, so the Democrats had to push through this bill that had stuff in that they knew was a bad idea.
No, it's completely true. By the way, Siri, what time is it in London?
Oh, it is...
In London, England, oh, it's 1:04 a.m.
1:04 a.m. And I assume that... Is it true that... Is all of England on the same Greenwich Mean Time?
Well, we're on British Summer Time at the moment. So we only have the one time zone. Huh. Despite it being bad for the Scots.
Oh, well, I mean, let's face it. The Scots are just a bunch of low-life heroin abusers, and no one really likes the Scots. They're like the West Virginia. They're the West Virginia of England, basically.
It's been quite funny, this whole Euro Championships, because there are four British nations, and then Republic of Ireland's kind of like an honorary fifth. So five home nations, inverted commas, and for football. And yet there's only four at the tournament. The Scots didn't get their invites.
Yeah, yeah. Somehow, you had England. Everybody knows England will make it to at least a group stage. You had Wales, who are, we talked earlier, but just being guided by maybe the greatest footballer on earth in Gareth Bale. And I, you know, it's funny because everybody thinks he's second fiddle because Ronaldo is such a big personality. But this tournament is really making me rethink things and go, oh, wait a second. He might really be the best. Like, he's scary good. Northern Ireland did well. Ireland did well. And Scotland, despite the fact that they all murder each other over Rangers and, you know, and all that stuff, they didn't really do anything, did they? Did you, Scotland, you dumb heroin addicts?
The whole joke about Scotland. So obviously you've seen Wales get to the knockout stage. You've seen the Republic of Ireland get to the knockout stage. Northern Ireland's done it in the past as well. Scotland, remember, Scotland was, you know, one of the first international football sides to ever be created because the English needed someone to play against. Scotland has never, ever got out of the group stage of an international tournament.
Really?
In Scotland's entire football history, have never managed to get out of the group stage. They've never managed it.
And they've had major, again, you know, Celtic Rangers and stuff. Like, these are clubs that are very big, and like, I cannot name a single club from, especially Northern Ireland or Iceland. Iceland has three, like, legitimately, for anybody listening, if you don't know, Iceland has 8% of the entire Icelandic population is in attendance at games when Iceland plays football. 97.8% of all televisions in Iceland were tuned to their last match. Like, Can you, if you had like 10% of Americans going to a game, that would be the equivalent of 30 million Americans showing up to a single game. That would be like, you know, or Britain, that'd be, you know what, 6 or 7 million yeah. people. It's like, and somehow Iceland, who does not have a single player that anybody's ever heard of, I don't think they have anybody above the Championship League playing on the team. And they, oh, by the way, this is where I get in my nerd zone. Like, oh, it's somebody that talks football. I can talk football with somebody. Oh, this is so much better than like yelling at my dogs and be like, why did he miss that fucking through pass? That was a really good one there. What's wrong with you? Oh, come on, Bastian Schweinsteiger. Although his name used to be Sebastian Schweinsteiger. And I thought, well, that's the most German name in the history of all German names. Like, Sebastian Schweinsteiger. I'm like, holy shit, your name just sounds like you're a Nazi. But, and they, yes, they did beat Italy. I was sad because I liked the idea that Italy would beat Germany again and again.
Well, it had these two laws of football physics, which is Italy always beats Germany, Germany always wins penalty shootouts, and one of them had to break.
And they
which one is going
to
break?
And it barely broke. I think they went to 9 on penalty kicks.
I mean,
like I'm watching it, and like they both missed high. We were, you know, DMing each other, whatever the fuck the kids call it. Bastian Schweinsteiger missed. Manuel Neuer had a brilliant save, and like watching this one. Holy shit, like, this is really intense. And then there's a part of me thinking, all I want is for the finals to be Iceland and Wales. Because it's, like, tomorrow, I think tomorrow's France and...
Tomorrow's France and Iceland, yeah. Yeah, like... I would so love it if Iceland win.
It
would be hilarious.
I really do think that... Iceland with their slow clap, which is so fun... Although I guess they stole it from a small British club, Millwood, I think they said, in England, did that first.
Millwall.
Yeah. Well, same thing. Whatever. You guys spell Worcester, you know, Worcester. So I'm not giving you any fucking credit on that one. but it's just such a really cool story, and it kind of goes back to what we were talking about, the idea of, you know, having a national identity, and... people not that weird mix of I don't want to be a racist, I want to be a bigot, but this is my culture. I'm French, I speak French, I eat baguettes, I drink, you know, wine. If you're Muslim and you wear a burqa and you don't do these things, are you really French? And I look at, like, you know, Iceland, and every single one of those dudes, you said, oh yeah, if I looked, oh, he's fucking Iceland. He has a beard, he's white, he's big, he would be an extra on Vikings on History Channel. Like, there's that weird, you know, dichotomy that I think that Europe just doesn't know how to deal with, because they want to preserve their history, and it's a great history. When I go to France, I love speaking French. I adore it. I want to embrace French culture. And I'm not, you know, my dad was the ugly American. He's like, oh, why don't they speak fucking English? I'm like, because they're French, you asshole. You fucking eat le baguette avec le chocolatier or whatever. And you just, you know, be French. But at the same time, you have that almost, we say Western, but maybe it's more American value of allow immigrants to come in. In America, we're so good of, oh, are you you're Mexican? Okay, we'll have Taco Bell, and we bastardize your culture. We have, you know, tacos at Taco Bell. We have pizza from Italy. We have, you know, whatever the fuck Germany gave us, and so on and so forth. We have, you know, Panda Express for the, I think it's Chinese or Japanese. I don't know which one it is. But in Europe, it's more difficult because you want...
And I said, the key thing is except France and Britain. So that's because, I mean, so I shouldn't pose to say except France, because I haven't been to France enough to know. But Britain, even a very small, like, say, like a small town, it will have your Italian takeaway, your Chinese takeaway, your Indian takeaway. you go to a bigger city, you'll probably then broaden out and have things like, you know, Portuguese steakhouses, African restaurants, you know. So I think, and this is where it you're right, I mean, it's kind of an odd one. I think the thing I always think with immigration, not so much immigration's bad, but to me it's got to be written with a narrative. You can't just welcome in a load of people that are, and then just say, well, these are people who are just here to work and earn money and they're just here, get used to it. And I think to a certain extent that's been done too much, even in America. You have to kind of explain a narrative, you know, so, well, these people are here and they are now part of our country for X, Y, Z, and you shouldn't be scared of them, you shouldn't feel threatened by them, everything's going to be fine, they're your neighbours now. And, you know, and part of that may be trying to, you know, explain into the immigrants that, you know, you have these responsibilities. So like, you know, my wife's an immigrant, you know, she came from Zimbabwe when she was about 19, and she already knew English, but she's a big believer that anybody in Britain should know how to speak English, because how else are you going to engage in society?
What a racist she is.
But I think there has to be that quite clear thing of, you know, here is the story we're telling people to explain what's going on. And I think too often, because again, the stuff on Eastern Europeans was just this really weird fluke. No one expected it to happen. Nobody was prepared for it. By the time it was happening, it was too late. Because, look, if that had happened due to a policy decision of the British government, the British government would have changed the policy. And we know this because when they sorted out the immigration system in the mid-90s, all of a sudden, immigration started massively increasing from other parts of the world. Immigration in the 50s and 60s massively increased from other parts of the world. And they quickly changed the policy to reduce numbers. But because it was this big thing of the European Union, they couldn't change the policy and they were just stuck with this issue. And people were getting more and more unhappy. But I just think, if you just talk to people, yeah, you do have to have limits on numbers. I don't think you can have just unlimited numbers, because the more people you have, the more difficult it is to integrate them into society. But as long as you say, look, these people have family here, these people have came to this important job, these people have these cultural links, it will work.
It's funny maybe. Because as I brag many times on Heffernan.com, I had Gavin McGinnis, who's been on, he founded Vice magazine and like all kinds of, like, he's a big deal. He's on the show recently and we're kind of talking, and I've always found it curious, and I'm repeating myself, but no one cares, that people will come to a country but not, you know, want to embrace that country. Like, you know, they want to come to England or America. And England and America are basically the same thing. Our values are identical. We're the same people. Just one of us uses a U for the word color and the other one doesn't. And I have no idea why you guys do that, because you're just color. There's no fucking U in it. You're not saying color, but whatever. It's fine. Little differences here aside, but it's like, in America, why would you come here and want to speak Spanish and do all your Spanish things? It's like, you know that what you left sucked. And this is part of my thing, is like, I hate St. Patrick's Day. I think it's the stupidest fucking holiday, because, yeah, my dad was 100% Irish. Like, all of his ancestors are from Ireland. So I'm, in theory, 50% Irish or some shit. My mom is a fucking mutt whore, so I got Norway and France and England and shit like that. But I always think, but if Ireland was good, we wouldn't have left it. Ireland sucked shit. That's why I'm here. Why would I want to celebrate a shitty country? And I think about, like, my life now, and it's like, the idea of moving from your country People don't want to do that. Your circumstances have to be so horrible, so terrible, so life-threatening for you to leave where you live. And that's why, like, when I see, like, the Syrian refugees, like, I believe that America, at least, should take every single Syrian refugee possible and bring them in. Put them in, like, you know, separate them out, don't make them full citizens or whatever, but that urge to leave where you live, I wouldn't leave America. I wouldn't move to Japan unless things were so terrible. And yet, all these people came to America from, you know, basically European countries. It's like, maybe they sucked shit. That's why you're here. Why do you want to glorify them now?
It's an interesting one. I suppose part of it is they blame the circumstances rather than the country. And obviously also one of the other things was it's because of the way immigration to America worked, and it went to key centers. And so you did get, you got groups, you know, you got your Irish sectors of New York, your Puerto Rican sectors of New York, your Italian sectors of New York. And, you know, the Democratic Party, the New York machinery encouraged this sense of nationality, fused loyalty.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, you talk to a lot of Irishmen. It does. You certainly get a feeling that St. Patrick's Day is a bigger deal in America than it is in Ireland itself.
Oh, for sure. Again, like, Ireland was it was a country that relied on basically farming fucking potatoes. Even though all of the water around Ireland had a great deal of fishing, they were too stupid to fish, apparently. So they came to America. There was a sign, no blacks and no Irish. Blacks and, you know, there was a nigger and Irish meant the exact same thing at one point. Irish were that low class, and I said the N-word. Fuck you, people. And yet nowadays we're like, oh yeah, I fucking love St. Patrick and all this stuff. Like, you don't even know, what did he do? He drove off some snakes or some shit? He probably just, like, was a dickhead that fucking beat up Jewish people or pagans or something like that. And they all think it's so great. I'm like, I don't care. Like, I like July 4th, Independence Day. It's like, that's America saying to Britain, hey, we're done. There's no taxation without representation. It's like kind of this modern movement and a very legitimate reason. And I kind of have a sense that if Britons look at it, they go, yeah, we were kind of shitty. We shouldn't have been taxing you guys, not giving you a vote in Parliament. But yeah, you're probably right. And I get that sense from England more than anybody else, where, like, India leaves England and everyone in England's like, yeah, that was the right thing for you to do. Australia leaves England and English people are like, yeah, probably shouldn't be controlling you. Same with Canada.
The thing is, what happened with India was different because British government was being racist.
Yeah.
But what happened with the white colonies after America was we did a big review of it and thought, you know what, we kind of screwed a pooch on that one. We really shouldn't have pushed them to go to war with us. What's the future? And what we realized was, is basically you let colonies get to a certain point, and then you don't give them independence, but you give them everything short of independence. You basically keep control of them, but you let them run their own affairs.
Like Scotland, basically.
Kind of like that. So you basically, you don't let them have a seat in Parliament, but you let them create their own Parliament that determines how they run their own internal affairs. But they still take orders from you in terms of foreign policy, defence policy. So Canada, Australia, New Zealand, it's really difficult to work out when they became independent, because in many ways they were functionally independent way before the Second World War.
Oh.
But they were quite clearly still taking orders from us as well. It's kind of a mishmash.
It's weird because I don't know what I was writing, but I was looking up something, and I think of Canada as having, you know, Canada's Canada. It's been a country for whatever, however long, like 5 years or something like that. But then I, all of a sudden I was reading, and I don't think Canada was officially an independent nation from the United Kingdom, it would be, until like 1980. I'm like, wait,
yeah.
You're Canada. Like, in no way did anybody ever think that Canada was anything but Canada. Like, they were not, you know, nobody ever thought Canada was part of Great Britain or England or anything, United Kingdom, but technically they still were. And it's like, what? Like, it's so weird to me, like, the idea that anybody, any country in this modern world of ours, and I know this, we're getting way off topic, who gives a shit? We don't have a topic. It's fun to say 2016, but even 1980, like, the idea that countries were, like, you know, declaring their sovereignty, it sounds like something that happened hundreds of years ago.
Well, that's the thing, they didn't declare, did they? They asked the British, could you please give us our sovereignty back? And we were like, oh, yeah, we do still have that.
Well, that's a Canadian way. They're very polite people. Like, you know, hey there, hoser, can we have our sovereignty back there, eh? And the British are like, oh, yeah, the fucking sounds pretty fucking good now then. Yeah, you can have your sovereignty back. And I know that my accent right now is more of a Cockney. Somebody one time told me that when I do an accent like this, that it's a Belfastian accent, because it's not...
Yeah, you know, I was about to say it sounded more Irish than British.
Yeah, I can't... For a little bit, I can do a bit of a posh British accent, but for the most part, I have to do the accent where I say the word fuck every couple of sentences, because that's the only one I know. And but given that I'm a Liverpool fan, and Liverpool were infiltrated by a bunch of Irishmen, and so they have a lot of Irish descendants there, and a lot of Irish red, and the great city of Liverpool, even though they didn't like Margaret Thatcher, and as a conservative...
For Liverpool, here's one for you. So Liverpool had so much immigration from Ireland that I think it was in the 1890s, the Irish nationalists actually won MPs in Liverpool.
Well, that's just how it is there in Liverpool, you know. We're just a very proud people. And by the way, fuck you, Everton and Lukaku. You fucking shit the bed there in the... you shite the bed there at the Euros with Belgium, you fucking piece of shite. Whereas, I've been wanting to know this for a long time. Mm-hmm. I have this weird sense. I know it's like almost like, you know, 4 a.m. for you. That of all, there are the big four clubs in England. Mm-hmm. Man United, Man City, Chelsea, and Arsenal. Fine. Fuck them all. They're all cunts. Right below them is Liverpool, who are, like, mm-hmm. you know, the former, in America, they're kind of like if the New York Yankees stopped being really good. But they were one of the most legendary clubs in England. And if Liverpool wins the Premiership, people would not be surprised. It would not be like when Leicester won it. You'd be like, what the fuck was that? We'd be like, oh, okay, Liverpool put together. Jurgen Klopp truly is a god. I love the man, and I offer up my firstborn child later on. But, where the fuck is my question? Fuck. England, Ireland, Liverpool. Fuck. There's a good question in here. Yeah. I have this sensation, or this, I don't know, feeling that for some reason, a lot of the English squad, the English national team, is from Liverpool more than any of the other big clubs. I don't know if that's true, but it just seemed like for a long time, even like Raheem Sterling, the traitor that he is, left for City, you know, from Liverpool, and you see, you know, Steven Gerrard for years and such. Is there something to that? That Liverpool is kind of the English
not so much,
team.
Not so much now, but yeah, it used to be for you. So I have Carragher, Owen, Gerrard, four day people like Robbie Fowler. So yeah, so Liverpool did produce a lot of English players, Man U would often contribute players, but they were more of Irish and Welsh.
Garbage, shitheads, fucking scumbags.
I mean, to be honest, at the moment, it's Tottenham, because, you know, both our fullbacks, Dele Alli, Harry Kane.
Yeah, that's true.
And Dyer. So, you know, quite a clear Tottenham spine, which wasn't probably the greatest idea, because Tottenham's players were mentally broken by the end of the season, and because they were in Europa League, had played, like, a billion games.
They fucking St. Tottenham's Day came true again. How is that possible?
That was the funniest thing. I mean, there's been a lot of funny things that happened this year, but when they somehow managed to finish first.
But also, it's a quirk of English football, but how fucking great would Tottenham have been if they'd been able to have Gareth Bale still in the squad?
Yeah.
I mean, Bale and Kane up front with Dele Alli and all these guys in the back, it's like, holy shit. Like, you'd have... I mean, Bale is obviously one of the... probably top five footballers in the world. Harry Kane... I think last season, everybody's like, was this a fluke? This season, he really solidified it and proved... Yeah. No, he's probably the best modern English player, because Rooney's in his 30s and he just got fat.
Shit.
And he's got hair plugs and stuff. He was concerned about his fucking hair. It's like, dude, you make like £50 million a year and you play football. You don't need hair, motherfucker. What? Why? How vain are you? So, Harry Kane's probably the best English-born player. Although I will say, as a Red, I do think that when you get near the box, that Daniel Sturridge has more finishing skills, that killer instinct, than almost anybody.
I think the problem with Sturridge is twofold. I mean, one, there's the issue of his injuries, which stops him. The other problem with him is he is very much a striker, that he's not brilliant at linking up the play. So one of the reasons why he was so great that season, where Liverpool almost won the title, was because he was playing with Suarez, and so Suarez would do a lot of the work for him, give him the ball, and then Sturridge would just do something amazing and score. And I think, you know, it'll be very interesting to see how this season goes, because I think Klopp finds Sturridge a bit frustrating, the fact that he won't do up the link play.
Yeah. I feel like Klopp has a version of the Dutch total football of, everybody needs to be able to play any time in any position, and everyone will work their ass off. And he likes guys that will basically run from one end of the pitch to the other and give everything for 90 minutes. Kind of like, you know, the old Bret Hart quote of, they run us down like circus animals and they put us out to pasture. That's kind of how Klopp looks at footballers. And that's why I see some of the younger guys in the team. Jordan Ibe always stands out to me. Henderson kind of is a... I think Henderson has a midfield hold-up position, more of a defensive midfielder than anything, even though people think he should be more offensive. I don't think he has the pace to do it. But Ibe and some of the other guys who can just flat-out run. And I think that's what Klopp wants from his forwards. And Sturridge has a great ability inside the box to make it happen. But you also have, Benteke, and he's...
Crystal Palace put in a bid for him.
Did they really?
Yeah, 25 million. Which, if I was Liverpool, I'd bite their fucking hat.
I actually really, really like Benteke as a bench player around 75 minutes or so to come in and give a different look, but I don't think you can pay those kind of wages to somebody to do that. And what they really need is...
He's all wrong for Klopp's style as well, because he's just not comfortable with ball to the feet. He wants crosses in, and it's not really the way Klopp really wants to play.
Benteke, I think, fits into, like, the traditional English style of football of, you know, you have some guys do X, Y, and Z. They bring the ball down. They give it to the striker. I think is a very good striker as far as holding the ball up, letting everybody get set. And then he passes it off to a winger. He gets in the middle. He tries to get for a cross for a header. And Klopp wants that more European style of everybody just swarms. And I've seen it. It went through all the entire Europa Cup where when they played that style, Liverpool was very, very good. It was like, oh my gosh, there's some real talent here. But I don't think Benteke is the kind of guy. And for £25 million, like, I know they spent like 30 something for him, but sell him and just go to Germany. Everybody in the world will look at everywhere from Dortmund and think, well, of course Klopp will get those guys. And I hope he does, because I think Liverpool really got lucky with Jurgen Klopp. They got a true world-class manager. And I'm so excited for the upcoming Premier season. By the way, everybody, fuck off. We're done with English politics. We're not talking about football. Because you look at the managers now in fucking England.
Oh, managers.
Fucking Pep Guardiola, who will have the chance to prove himself, which is really weird for a guy that won every single thing you can ever win.
Will he prove himself? Because if he does win anything with Man City, we're all just going to turn around and say, well, of course he won with Man City. They're the richest club in the world.
If he can take Man City and win the championship, not the championship. If he wins the Champions League, I will say, okay, fine. Winning it with Barcelona, I have a feeling that if I was a manager of Barcelona, I was like, hey, Messi and Suarez, just do what you do. And Xavi, you know, hold it up a little bit. And, you know, Neymar, you do whatever you want to do too. They probably win, 35 out of 38 games, whatever they play in, Spain, and get to the semifinals or finals of the, you know, Champions League.
I mean,
same with Bayern Munich.
Bayern. I mean, not winning the Champions League with Bayern is a bit of a black eye, considering how much money they spent and the fact that the previous manager did win it with them. So he spent all this money and the team hasn't reached the levels of his predecessor. Mourinho at Man U, that is going to be fascinating. Oh. Zlatan has now joined him as well. So we've got Ibrahimovic in the Premier League finally.
And you know what? Honestly, like, everybody looks at Mourinho, who has earned his respect. The guy has gone to every club he's ever been at and been a winner. This last half season sucked, fine. And I just think he's funny. Guardiola won everything. Yeah, he didn't win the Champions League with Bayern Munich, but he won the Bundesliga multiple times, and that's probably a better example.
Yeah, but the thing is, you drunk could win the Bundesliga with Bayern.
True, but he still did it. He didn't fuck it up. And, you can look at Arsene Wenger, and yeah, Arsenal will finish fourth place. We all know that. That's just the Wenger Cup. But there is something to be said for a guy that's been able to keep a club in the top four for as long as he has. Like, there's a lot of clubs in England that would die to be that consistently successful. Yeah, he doesn't take a lot of chances, but he managed that club through financial difficulty when they had the new Emirates Stadium coming in. And, you know, again, I think the whole Champions League is so overblown. It's such a crapshoot. You see so many good teams just kind of, Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid in the finals this year, and I don't think either one of them were the top two clubs. I think it was Bayern and Barcelona, and they should have faced each other in an ideal world. But, you know, luck of the draw. Fucking no joke, everybody, the four of you that are listening, Real Madrid had an easier road to the finals of the Champions League than Liverpool did to the finals of Europa League.
Oh, that Europa League run was a murderer's row, because you had Man U, you had Dortmund, you had Villarreal in the semis, and then you had Seville.
Yeah.
I mean, that was pretty mental. The thing with Barcelona were the best team in Europe last season. They just happened to go through a really bad run of form during the semi-finals of the Champions League, which caused them to get knocked out by Atletico. I think there's no, you know, you just look at how they bossed La Liga. But yeah, the Premier League's going to be fascinating, because so you've got the big four. So you've got a big five, if you include Liverpool. But then you remember, Tottenham and Leicester, the two teams of last season, are still there. And, you know, Leicester's buying new players, Tottenham will buy new players. So that's seven. You then got West Ham, who dropped off a bit, but also were very good last season, will be making a lot more money now, because they'll have their big new stadium, because they're taking over the Olympic Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you got Everton will have a new manager and more money being spent with new owners. Plus, you got Southampton. I mean, you've got 10 teams that may be challenging for Champions League places. That's a big difference from what's gone before.
Oh, for sure. Again, going back to the managers, you have Wenger, you have Guardiola, Klopp, Mourinho, and then you go down to Tottenham with Pochettino. I think Pochettino may be the best of all of them for what he's done with Tottenham, which he took a mid-level club, and they are no doubt almost automatic Champions League qualifiers at this point, after having had, you know, years of being the joke of Tottenham only place in Europa, and they.
I would just say with Tottenham, let's see what they're like this season, because, you know, with Chelsea self-destructing, with Man U self-destructing, with Liverpool changing their manager, with the issues Man City had, it might be that this season was less about Tottenham and Leicester having great seasons, they both did, and more about the big clubs just being asleep at the wheel. I wouldn't be surprised if Tottenham are back to being fifth or sixth this season.
Yeah,
they have to be a lot better than they were last season.
I can see that, like, for sure. I think Leicester will just fall back. Although, that said, when Jamie Vardy did get minutes in Europa, he did very well. And I was kind of, like, surprised by that, because I'm like, oh, maybe it's just a product of, you know, a little hot streak there, a good system. But no, like, I think he's still, like, 29 or 30, so he's just a little too old. Mahrez is young and good, but I don't know. I still think
Vardy is what it is people are just going to sit back off him. No, he needs a high line. You know, when he came on against Iceland just started putting their defenders against the penalty box line, and then if he's got no space, he's neutralized.
Yeah, it's and it'll just be so. I mean, we have. I really think that the drama of next year's premiership will be about as good as it gets, because the normal Liverpool Manchester derby will be taken up a hundredfold, because you have the special one and the normal one. You take the normal Manchester derby of that's magnified with, you know, Mourinho and Guardiola. And then, you know, you throw in the London derby with Tottenham and Chelsea, and or Tottenham and Arsenal. It's like, holy shit. Like, I feel like every weekend we'll have some really, really big, important match. And I know I'm lucky, because I'm in America. We get every single game. I can watch every single one of them from the comfort of my couch for free, and I know you don't get to get that. And the only downside is it's way too early in the morning to drink. Other than that, it's magnificent.
It's never too early.
Trust me, it's 6:30. I have woken up at 6:30 in the morning to watch Liverpool. There's no way in shit I'm drinking at 6:30 in the morning.
I remember I had to go to Trinidad for a friend's wedding, and so I think Liverpool were playing, and it was, it must have been, let me get this right, it had been like 8 o'clock in 8 o'clock in Trinidad. We still drank. It was a wedding.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have any friends that watch football here. Mostly, it's like, really, you watch that gay soccer stuff? I'm like, fuck you, it's really cool. And, like, people don't understand, like, I'll be at work, and one of the greatest things ever was listening to the Liverpool feed of the play-by-play for the Europa League. I had never listened to it before. I always watched, you know, just watched the games. So I got a bit of an objective view. And when I listen to guys who are just what we would call homers, I'm like, holy crap, this is awesome. Like, these guys are like, oh, that's a bullshit call. Fucking Liverpool should have fucking won that one. That's a fucking bullshit tackle. Oh, no, fuck you. That's fucking bullshit. Fuck you. Oh, fucking Sturridge should have a fucking PK right now. And I'm like, oh, this is so cool. I'm like, this is all I ever wanted, was somebody to watch a game with and be like, yeah, let's go crazy being stupid. And instead, I just got two puggles that look at me and be like, they sleep, and then occasionally I go, woohoo! And they wake up, they look at me, and they go, you asshole. And then they go back to sleep.
And on that note, I should probably go to sleep.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm like, this went way too long. So everybody, I hope you learned something more about British politics. Happy 4th of July, the day when America said we don't want to be part of England, even though we liked every single part of England that's good. And we still have our special relationship. And Will, I thank you. We did plug last time for Fight Sport magazine and Fighting Spirit, I should say, magazine, yep, and shit like that. Hey, look at that. I actually think I've been in it a couple times. I don't know why, but...
I think I've quoted you.
You're a smart man. But anyways, you have a wife, children, all that shit. So thanks again. I'll hang up the phone. You'll be free to, you know, enjoy your. I guess you have a bank holiday. I don't. What's the opposite of Independence Day? Kind of like the cut the cord day. Got rid of the the annoying kid day or whatever it is. But again, thanks for doing the show. I hope everybody listening learned a lot, because I legitimately did also, and I should probably learn to do a show in an hour instead of three. So thanks again, Will, and I'll talk to you again. Take care.
Take care, man. You too. Bye.
Aggressively, we all defend the role we play. Regrettably, times come to send you on your way. We've seen it all, bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about. We hope.